It doesn't mean you can explain the ocean. A supernatural fanfic written by Rageproof Rock. Read by Apple Juice. Rated for teen and up audiences. There are noises in the cosmic grapevine about three women in Savannah, about prophecy and oracle and older gods than even they know the words for. And Dean hears about it from a waitress at the counter of a diner off the side of a North Carolina freeway. It's muggy outside, like collards and carrot tops and green gumbo, stewed until it's mostly brown, like mudslides and the thick scum left on everything after a storm. Sue, whose brother is a sergeant serving in Afghanistan still, wears a yellow ribbon on the breast pocket of her server's uniform and snaps her gum as she tops off Dean's coffee. She talks about how she misses her baby brother, and how she's real proud of him for standing up for his country and fighting for the sake of the freedom of the U.S. of A. She tells Dean her mama's the best damn quilter on this side of the Carolinas, and that she'd be happy to take Dean around this sleepy southern town if he's going to be around these parts for a few more days. Sam drinks sweet tea and listens to her chatter at his brother, stacks a Land O'Lakes non-dairy creamers into a pyramid and listens to newspapers rustle, the metallic slick and slide of spatulas and things on the hot griddle, the shouting of the Mexican short order cook. The diner smells like the meatloaf blue plate special and frying sausage and bacon, smells like the steak and eggs Dean ordered with his black coffee. Sam looks at the counter's ugly, speckled blue linoleum and the pleather covers of the diner stools, split open, with the fluff inside spilling out. "Now what's this about oracles?" Dean says, and he drags out all the syllables in oracle until Sue laughs, eyes bright, and winks. "It's just highway chatter now, y'all hear," she says. "But truckers have been coming in saying there's three wise women in Savannah, set up shop in a rickety shack by the freeway, shaking and shivering and channeling the spirits, they tell me." "Any of them actually been to them?" Dean asks, leaning forward on his elbows. Sue leans right back, and Sam doesn't know what the hell Dean is talking about when he says people like Sam better. People trust Sam more because of his earnest expression and bashful bangs. People know Dean's trouble and follow him anyway. Sam follows him anyway. "A few," Sue prevaricates and smirks. "Why, you looking to have your future read?" Dean laughs and leans back. "No, ma'am, I am a man who appreciates the mystery of life." Sam rolls his eyes, and Sue wipes down the part of the counter in front of Dean's half-empty plate of egg detritus and steak grizzle for the 40th time. Sam's needed more tea for almost half an hour, and when he looks pleadingly at the other waitress in the diner, she just raises her brows in challenge before going back to her backdated copy of Cosmo, dog-earing pages for future reference. Sam thinks meanly that she'll never get to use all their fashion tips, replacing drugstore cover girl for the makeups available only in New York, London, and Milan, and she'll never buy any Oscar knockoff dresses and never dine at Nobu. He thinks that no matter how much Cosmo she reads, she'll always work in this backwater nowhere with a special on Duplin County wines, and she'll never be more than exactly what she is. "Too curious, then," Sue decides with a grin. "They say that stuff killed the cat, you know."
"Good thing I'm a dog, Sue," Dean laughs,
and peels a couple of fives out of a wad he's keeping in his pocket. They taste like cheap-ass bud and the smokehouse pool hall they'd been in the night before, where Dean let at least three hard bodies punk him before he'd ripped them all a new one on the green felt. She rolls her eyes and laughs, but it's warm and sweet and well within her means, and Sam wonders how people sometimes know when things are beyond them. Sam's always wanted so much he couldn't have. Sue wanders off with the cash to make change, and Dean purses his mouth before saying, "You ever hear anything about the Southern Mystics, little brother?"
"Not to my knowledge, no," Sam answers. "I didn't know the South had mystics."
"The South has Pentecostals," Dean laughs. "Signs and wonders, trance-like states." They once hunted evil snake handlers in Appalachia. Dean hates snakes almost as much as he hates flying, which made it one of Sam's favorite memories from his childhood. His brother crawling up a tree and shrieking, "Back off, fucking lizards of Satan!"
before Sam said snakes could climb. There is, if Sam thinks about it, an enormous body of memory colored by fondness, washed of all the fear he must have felt as a kid, and now just an absent collection of facts and anecdotes, stories about Sam and Dean and Dad. Sam raises an eyebrow. Are you saying you want to find the oracles? Dean gives him a look. No interest in knowing the future, Sammy, he answers. You never thought about it? Sam asks, curious. About how this all might end up? About where you'll be in 10, 15 years? I know where I'll be, Dean says automatically. It's just the company that changes. And before Sam can start a fight with Dean about taking cheap shots, Sue comes back with their change and a white paper bag of lemon squares, dusted sweet with powdered sugar, and she presses it into Dean's hands, saying, I won't hear a word of it. It's on the house. From Sue. Even as Dean tells her, Ma'am, we couldn't possibly. This is too kind. Y'all drive safe now, you hear? She tells them, and waves from behind the counter as they gather up their things to go. Dean gives her a backward glance and a wide, wide smile while Sam pushes him into the sultry August heat, near choking on the moisture, and runs his hands over the cheap aluminum handles of the door, sizzling hot on his skin. The way Dean tells it, their parents were never in for psychics and all that paranormal mumbo-jumbo. They went to the local Methodist church, with their mother putting Dean in his Sunday best and combing John's hair. There was no praising of Jesus, but Dean was always told not to take the Lord's name in vain, which is probably why he does it as much as humanly possible these days. Dean does not take part in the assorted ridiculousness indigenous to the area, and does not care about his zodiac sign, which is Virgo, or listen to his horoscope when Sam reads it out loud to him from whichever trashy magazine he's found left behind in whichever trashy motel they sleep in whichever night. Dean does not believe in faith healers, unless they have enslaved a reaper, and under which circumstances Sammy is to let him fucking die, which is the direct quote Sam intends on directly contradicting for as long as they both shall live. Or mystics. Dean believes there is the supernatural and the natural, and that it is in the places that the twain meet where they drive with purpose. Our history, Sammy, Dean likes to say, grinning in an ironical way, is of God-fearing Midwesterners. We don't partake in the devil's work. We are the devil's work, Sam likes to laugh back. Well, praise be, Dean will say, and drop his foot on the gas until they've burned enough highway to burn the thought out of their minds, like they are now, driving straight down from Jersey to Fort Lauderdale, where Dean knows a guy who knows a guy who knows of some sort of alligator with two heads and a taste for human flesh. Sam wants to know what the fuck kind of supernatural event that is, other than nuclear waste getting into the waterways and streams. He suspects Dean just wants to see a two-headed alligator. God damn it, Sam! Dean yells from the car. Move your ass! Sam rolls his eyes and the man grins at him, bushy whiskers twitching, from behind the gas station counter, and passes him $1.36 in change and 2 Snickers bars, 1 toothbrush, 1 travel-sized mouthwash, 1 package travel-sized Kleenex tissue, 5 sticks of beef jerky, 6 pack of Mountain Dew, 1 copy of the Southern Pines Pilot, 1 red, white, and blue lighter. I swear to fucking God, Sam, Dean calls out again. Twitchy some bitch, ain't he? The register man says, and Sam takes his time pocketing his change and folding up his newspapers, stuffing them under one arm. You have no idea, Sam confides. The first psychic I ever really met was Missouri, Dean explains, gnawing at the wrapper of his Snickers bar until Sam snatches it out of his mouth and opens it for him. Dean, who has this shit-eating smile on his face, just opens his mouth like he's working the neighborhood glory hole and waits for Sam to shove it back in there. I think I remember psychics from when we were young, Sam says, and helps himself to a Mountain Dew. Dean shakes his head. Shamans, priests, any and all kinds of people, yeah. But Dad never went looking for fortune tellers. I don't know, Sam. They creep me out. Psychics creep you out? Sam demands. Psychics? Dean scowls at him. Bitch, shut your mouth. Of all the demons you've vanquished. Vanquished? Dean repeats sarcastically, like he wasn't the one to teach Sam that word to begin with. When Sam was in the second grade and Dean fell in love with comic books for one whole long, soggy summer in Washington State. Vanquished, and all the spirits you've killed, and that time you were almost eaten by a bear out of sheer stupidity, Sam continues. You're creeped out by psychics? Man, Dean argues, they dig around your head. They, you know, prophecy. Don't you think it's a little wrong and strange to know what will happen before it happens? Okay, wow, your powers of compartmentalization astound me, Sam mutters. Dude, if I know what that meant, I'd totally be insulted, Dean says. Sam just rolls his eyes. It's not worth the fight. Dean was never as dumb as he likes to pretend he is. Somewhere along the line, Sam's brother decided it was easier to get by if everybody thought he was prettier than he was bright. Which Dean very probably is, but he is very, very pretty. Or maybe it's negative reinforcement. Sam was always the smart one, Dean was always the cute one, and then somewhere along the lines of puberty, all the lines got crossed and Dean went the way of slightly dangerous with a leather jacket and a 5 o'clock shadow, while the girls in the Future Librarians of America Club all wrote Mrs. Sam Winchester all over their trapper keepers. It might have been a fluke, but it happened at 3 separate middle and high schools, so Sam thinks that in terms of sociology, it's statistically significant. Did you ever read up on the Oracle at Delphi? Sam asks suddenly, and taps his fingers on the dashboard of the car, listening to Iron Maiden struggle out of the car stereo system. Sam's been tempted more than once to just set Dean's fucking cassettes on fire, but he has no real inclination to A. see his brother cry, B. see his brother really pissed again, or C. see the face of baby Jesus when Dean kills him for destroying the Metallica mix he spent half of his 10th grade year making. A little, when it popped up, Dean says, and looks sideways at Sam. Why? They pass a sign that says, South Carolina, 96, which makes Sam wonder about arbitrary numbers and wasting taxpayer money. I don't know, man. Oracles. They don't just pop up on the sides of highways, Sam says. Dean laughs. There is a lot of strange and fantastic shit people do not advertise, Samuel. Sam raises an eyebrow. Like being an oracle? Like seeing the fucking future, man, Dean says. I mean, did you tell everybody when you started channeling the spirit of Elton John? Elton John isn't dead, Sam snaps, and I'm not channeling anybody. It's just a touch of extrasensory perception, then, Dean allows. Fuck you very much, Sam says feelingly. Okay, Buttercup, whatever you say, Dean tells him casually. Sam hasn't had any dreams recently. When he does sleep, he sleeps like the dead. But he has this twisted childlike worry that if he talks about it, they'll come back. He can't tell if he's been cursed or blessed or some twisted crossing of the two. He keeps telling himself, you saved Dean's life. That's good enough. That's good enough reason to have this damn thing. They roll past a South Carolina 86 sign before Dean clears his throat to say, any particular reason you're so stuck on these oracles, Sammy? Don't call me Sammy. Don't try to avoid the question, Dean tells him. Come on, Sam. Sam shrugs. It's hard to do in a contained space, even a car as big and gas-guzzling as the Impala. He looks out a window and ignores the hair that falls into his eyes. I don't know, I just thought it was kind of interesting that she used the word oracle specifically. Oracles channel gods and goddesses, Dean muses. Give divine guidance. Sam laughs. Sounds good. Sounds like a tourist trap, Dean says meanly, but there's an altogether too nice smile on his mouth. You need guidance in life, Sammy? I get you a copy of Our Bodies Ourselves you can read in the back seat and commune with your inner woman. You know, for someone who acts like such a slimeball to women, Sam says innocently, you seem to quote pretty easily about sociological feminist literature, Dean.
Everybody goes through a phase as a teenager, Dean says, grinning conspiratorially, and Sam laughs all the way to the South Carolina 76 sign.
Basically, it comes down to the fact that Sam doesn't know what the hell he's doing, and he's too chicken shit to ask Dean if he does. It's the sort of dilemma that's embarrassing enough and you haven't already been doing it for more than 7 months. It's downright shameful now to start the conversation. Besides, Sam already knows Dean's answers. Dean will say, "We're doing it to find the thing that killed Mom. We're doing it to find the thing that killed Jess. We're doing it because it's the right fucking thing to do. Jesus fucking Christ, Sammy."
Plato went on a 35-year learning spree to prove the Oracle wrong, Dean says suddenly. Sam blinks.
What?
The Oracle said no one was wiser than Socrates, and so Plato spent the next 35 freaking years being a petty little bitch and trying to one-up the S-Man, Dean says patiently.
I didn't know that, Sam says. Why do you know that?
Ow, Dean mutters.
No, seriously, nobody knows that. Why do you know that? Sam demands.
My cassette player busted once in Alabama and I got stuck listening to NPR, Dean admits. Cool story, though, isn't it?
Sure, Sam agrees. Dean's never read Plato, nor his recounting of Socrates, which is either wisdom or a sign of distinct lack of curiosity. Sam read The Republic once for his poli-sci classes, and still hasn't recovered. He thinks that if he and Dean and his father were an island, and if they were the Kallipolis, Dean would be a protector because he lives and dies by his mission, and doesn't seem to want anything enough to keep it.
If you're into disproving oracles, Sam adds.
It would be a really fucking lonely city, Sam concludes, because his father would be a warrior too, and Sam would be the lone merchant in a city of shining walls with no philosopher king, and he'd peddle fruits and wines to nobody and wait for war.
Yeah, who does that? Dean says, distracted.
So the secret subtextual message that Sam isn't getting across is that he doesn't know what he's doing, but the oracles might, and Dean's so goddamn sure of himself that it fills up all the space, crowds out second thoughts and warring desires and Sam's uncertainty, until Sam falls asleep listening to Dean's seemingly seamless confidence, and wakes up to his brassy assurances that they're doing the right thing, they're fighting the good fight, that in the end, they're gonna be fucking golden.
Okay, seriously, Sam? We're getting you the happy ball meds, Dean tells him.
Sam's eating Cheetos out of the bag, and his entire fist is orange. Dean's already made the requisite sexual jokes about citrus, and Sam's already told him the requisite fuck off, you pervert, and now they're sitting at some picnic tables at a rest stop staring at the South Carolina border.
Because of the Cheeto fisting? Sam asks, baffled.
Shit, Dean cusses, horrified. No, and that's disgusting.
But you just...
Dude, it's funny when it's fruit,
Dean tells him like that's an accepted fact, and barrels on before Sam can tell him what a fucking psychopath he is.
No, man, I'm talking about this preoccupation of yours with knowing the exact right answer at the exact right time. This oracle stuff in your craw, it's just you wanting to get all the multiple choice right on the test again.
It is not, Sam argues, feeling his ears redden. There is a possibility that Dean is right.
It so is, Dean crows and points at him. Look, you're getting red.
I fucking hate you, Sam mutters.
Mr. Sam Winchester, on the picnic table, with a baseball bat in his rectum, Dean declares happily, and mugs for an invisible crowd Sam has no doubt he actually sees.
Thanks, I'll be here all week. For two kids who grew up on the road with a semi-alcoholic father who hunted paranormal shit for a not-real-impressive living, Sam can't help but think that Dean managed to sneak in a revolting amount of absent suburban normalcy, which Dean loathes on principle.
Sam's Psych 101 class, says Dean's just lashing out because he never had that which he so commonly sees in others. Sam also knows better than to quote Psych 101 at Dean. Like you would actually argue against a little forward warning, Sam says. I mean, do you really not want to know what the best way to do things is? Life could be so simplified. He could either fight dirty with dirty or logic. He's not going to win, but he'd lose much faster if he tried to out-perv his brother, who once spent a solid 3 hours between Michigan and Indiana, making up an insanely pornographic yarn about a bestial BDSM gangbang in which he was the central party favor, for the sole purpose of making Sam say, "Dude, shut the fucking fuck up," every 5 minutes. Sam would never tell him, but Dean's awesome like that. How is hedging your bets on somebody who sniffs shit and babbles at you in Greek any more reliable and safe than just throwing yourself into it feet first? Dean replies. It sounds bad when you put it like that, Sam mutters. Because it is bad. They were huffing vapors, Sam. That's not divination, it's drug abuse. But they were right on a lot of big things. So am I, Dean says sympathetically. Remember when I said Disco was dead? God, Sam says, and rubs at his face. Let's just get back on the road. Sam feels like his ass has molded to the car seat, that they're never going to get off this road, and he feels rubbed raw like a sandpaper accident in 8th period shop. He thinks about Mom and Dad and Dean and Jess and knowing better. Always knowing better, but wanting more than he could. Should. Have. And taking bigger risks than Dean or Dad ever had in order to have them. Sam's not fated for this life. That much he knows is true. The hard part is getting off the fucking freeway. Dean's pounded every mile of blacktop in America, practically, and Sam thinks that one day, if Dean wrote a book about the Great American Road Trip, it'd be the New York Times bestseller, no questions asked. Dean could edit stories about demon beasts and vengeful spirits until it was just the French facts that made the cut. The rolling green-gray weed in Middle America, dark trees in Vermont, and ice slicks in Michigan. Dean could talk about how he'd been invited in for sweet tea in 7 separate states, and been told over time to vote Democrat, Republican, against the government period, and for the rebel states because the end of the War of Northern Aggression was still raging. When Dean's not listening to the same tired Metallica albums, he's telling Sam all the stories from the 4 years he was at school and ignoring his family, like Dean's trying to build a bridge between where Sam is sitting on the other side of the Impala and what it's like to be in Dean's shoes. His entire life, Dean's been explaining things to Sam, and Sam might have stopped listening around the 4th grade, but Dean is still talking, and will until his voice gives out. "I can hear you thinking from all the way over here," Dean tells him. Sam shakes his head. "It's nothing. You want me to drive a while?" he asks. "I'm good," Dean says, smooth and honey brown. "My baby and I, we have a connection." "It never gets less disturbing to hear you talk that way about an inanimate object," Sam laughs. "Man, I remember the way you used to cuddle your G.I. Joe." "At least it was shaped like a person," Sam says. "A male person," Dean points out as they pass another I-95 South sign. Sam's only been down this stretch of road a few times. There's too much God in the Bible Belt to leave much space for good, honest demon hunting, but he remembers palm trees and Civil War forts, the Union Jack flag in small-town car windows. He thinks he might have had cheesed grits in a restaurant down here once when he was small. "South's changed a lot since the last time you were here," Dean murmurs, like he's been reading Sam's mind all this time. "Looks the same," Sam says softly as they drive through the county of Dillon towards Florence. "Small towns, the nothing spots between places, they always look the same," Dean says. "But man, I remember the first time Dad and me and you drove through these parts, and there was nothing there but tobacco and trees.
Last time I got fucking lost on my way to Kentucky and found the parking lot of a pharmaceutical company.
Which one? Sam asks.
Who knows? It had a swirly symbol thing, Dean says, shrugging.
All of them have swirly symbol things, Sam says disapprovingly.
Which says a lot about their marketing and branding staffs, right?
Dean squints at a sign ahead and says,
Okay, so Florence, then Sumter, then Clarendon.
You should write a book, Sam says suddenly.
Dude, about what? Dean asks, perplexed.
I don't know, driving. You've driven everywhere.
It's because I have that thing with Flying Princess, nothing to advertise, Dean says, rolling his eyes hugely. Besides, what the hell could I write about? Women in white? Poltergeists? The Wendigo?
Might prove a useful public service, Sam points out.
Or it could be sold under the sci-fi fantasy section, Dean grins.
Plus, I'm not the scholar in the family. You want the great American novel, Sammy? You write it.
But you're the one who lived it. Write what you know, Sam argues.
Dean's shoulders slump in shame.
I knew I never should have let you read Little Women during your formative years.
Whatever, Sam laughs. I saw you crying over The Giving Tree.
I did not cry, Sam.
Okay, so your eyes were watering from allergies.
Man, I do not have allergies, Dean sulks. I knew it was a mistake to get you that library card.
After the first big fight Sam and his dad ever had,
I'm going to miss the science fair if I go. And, son, this is bigger than the science fair. Don't you get it, Sam?
Dean woke Sam up on a Sunday and walked him out to the county public library and got Sam a card. He was 8, and the librarian at the counter gave him a thin black permanent marker to sign his name on the back of the green plastic card. She smiled and said, It's so nice to see brothers looking out for each other, and not so many kids like to read these days. Then Dean gave him a duct tape wallet to put the card in, and 5 $1 bills and a roll of quarters for emergencies.
What should I get? Sam had asked, breathless at the walls and walls of books.
Dude, do I look like I read? Dean had laughed.
Get whatever you want.
Sam tried reading all the Goosebumps books because all the other kids in his class were doing it, but they were unrealistic and all the ghosts were lame and none of the kids threw salt or holy water on anybody. So he read the Little House on the Prairie books and Gordon Corman and the Yellow Brick Road and the Wizard of Oz. He read Ender's Game and secretly read a bunch of Star Trek novels, which he kept hidden underneath a stack of old math homework under the seat of Dean's car. He remembers being halfway out of the state that time, before remembering he still had 3 in the car, and having a meltdown about stealing even as Dean herniated something laughing at his big fat loser of a baby brother hiding Star Trek novels under his homework.
"Did I ever thank you for that?" Sam asks.
Dean blinks in surprise.
What, the library card?
Yeah, Sam smiles.
Dean's eyes round in surprise before he bursts out laughing.
Man, you are easy. That thing was free. Easiest present I ever got anybody.
One time, completely by accident about 2 months ago, Sam found the 3 Star Trek novels from forever ago in a Tupperware container of stuff Sam left behind when he ran away to Stanford. It was underneath Dean's tricked-out weapons pavilion in the trunk of the car. The books haven't been read since Dean explained they'd mailed the library an apology letter and some cash for the books, but they're still there, in almost perfect condition, and Sam wonders why Dean keeps any of this shit. Or is it just an elaborate conspiracy to make Sam feel like a douchebag for ever wanting to leave his family for something different? The point is, Sam would read Dean's book, if for nothing else, to figure something out about his brother.
He is not, Dean says defensively. Sam gapes.
You're kidding, right? He demands.
No way. You're serious?
God damn it, Sam, he is not, Dean insists.
Sam flashes the tabloid in Dean's face.
Did you see these pictures? You do realize you are attempting to make a point with something called the National Tattler, right, Sammy? Dean sneers. What, are you like a claymate or something? Sam huffs, annoyed. Of course he's gay.
Dude, Dean snaps, crinkling his nose in disgust.
What was that filthy word you just used?
Sam blinks. Gay?
No, fucker. Claymate. What the hell is that?
Dean demands.
Dean and Sam do not have long, heartfelt discussions about their mutual feelings on various social issues. Sometimes, when they're in the checkout aisles of all-night grocery stores, and Dean is reading the most offensive headlines to him while they wait for the register biscuit to scan their 17 tubes of Pringles, Dean will say something like, "That's a real cock in the ass," about having 16 alien babies. But then he'll say, "It'll be a raging bitch to get child support from that jackass." And Sam will be too busy rolling his eyes to dissect the potentially homophobic meanings behind Dean's diction. Dean seems to see the world in two dimensions of inhabitants, awesome and not awesome. When Dean was in 11th grade, he had some sort of treatise about this. Clay Aiken fans, Sam explains.
Goddamn, Dean says in hushed horror. Claymates?
So you see what I'm saying. Sam pushes, tapping his finger on the grainy webcam shots of Aiken attempting to get his seduction on with somebody, male, on the other end. Sam thinks all things considered, it's more sad than scandalous. Sam overheard somebody at Stanford say, "Clay? No way. He's too religious to be gay." Sam didn't know before anybody could be too religious to be gay, but upon reflection, it makes sense.
Just because his fan club is fucked up doesn't mean he's a skeezy queer, Dean decides. I mean, look at the Southern Baptists.
Sam raises an eyebrow. Point.
Yeah, 'cause even the sweet love of baby Jesus can't save their asses, Dean concludes. Also, are we really having a conversation about Clay Aiken?
Clay Aiken could still be gay, Sam says. He has no idea why he cares if Clay Aiken is gay.
Whatever, Dean mutters.
I mean, okay, do you hate gay people? Sam asks, and he feels like a total moron when Dean gives him this look he reserves for guys who hit their girlfriends and people who sell life insurance.
Okay, forget I asked that, Sam adds quickly.
No, Dean contradicts. I might not have gone to liberal, nut-grabbing, bra-burning you, but with all the shit I see on this job, who you fuck becomes way less important than what you fuck with.
Dean raises his eyebrows at the tabloid Sam's still holding up.
Claymates, he mutters in disgust one last time for emphasis.
Then Dean gets a phone call and excuses himself to go answer it where he actually gets, you know, reception, and the night waitress wanders up to top off his coffee and pat Sam on the hand. She purses her deeply rouged mouth and her blue-shadowed eyes crinkle in a supportive smile as she says, "Don't worry, sugar, he'll come around," and gives him a piece of pie on the house.
"Oh, no, it's not," Sam tries to tell her.
"Don't you worry about a thing," she hushes him. "We respect all kinds of love." She's got a cross necklace on, fake laboratory jewels thickly embedded, but it's clearly dear to her, comfortable with age. Sam thinks about her and maybe a girlfriend and maybe a dog in a little house not too far from here, about her crawling into bed after a long shift, the murmuring rearrangement of limbs until they are tangled together, slow and molasses sweet. It's a good thought, he decides, that some people might not be too religious to be gay.
In the end, Sam says, "All right," and "Thanks for the pie."
Outside, the night is deep and huge, and the orangey lights from the highway barely cut into it, like tattered veils at a distance, pooling on the asphalt. Sam can hear the high, thin sound of cars rushing through the wind and the rumble of engines in the parking lot. Over it all, the soft sound of dishes and the voices in the truck stop, and when Sam opens his eyes, the entire restaurant is burned out, bleached white from two bright bulbs that he'll never get used to, not even after a lifetime of midnight stops for eggs and griddle cake and sausage biscuits and flour gravy. Sam's eyes feel dry and the skin on his face and hands feels papery. He bends his fingers, tightens a fist around the fork, feels the bone and flesh surge against the skin, and wonders what it would be like to burst out of it, what he'd be like if he shed his skin like a snake. But it makes him think about the skinwalker wearing Dean's face as he died, and Sam shakes the memory out of his head, hearing it rattle and shriek. If Sam only takes one thing away from this journey he's on, it's that he's sick of watching people he loves die, sometimes twice. When Dean comes back and says, "Hey, why didn't you get me pie?" Sam says, "Because you're an ass." Behind the counter, the waitress winks at him and flashes him a thumbs up. Sam smiles back, because it's not the first time or the second time or even the 10th time that somebody thought he and Dean were claymates. This time, at least, he got pie out of the deal and not a dirty look at the battered counter of a cheap motel. Sam was gay once. It's like a rule in college. Everybody's a little gay. Sam was a little gay for 2 months. "It's okay, Sam," Jessa told him. "I've kissed more girls than guys." "Wow," Sam had said. "That's really hot." She'd laughed. "Isn't it?" It was just a thing he did. Driving around killing demons and werebeasts and fighting vengeful spirits is just another thing he does. Sam's still invested in being normal someday, but he's not so upset about the absence of it now. Sam's listening to NPR so softly he might as well turn the radio off, but Dean's asleep, leaning against the car window, and this is one small passive-aggressive victory that Sam will allow himself in their epic battle of driver versus cakehole. After 2 months of radio silence immediately after Sam left for college, Dean sent him a postcard from Montreal with a picture of a goat wearing a dress on it. He'd written, "Bitchface, P.S. don't major in philosophy," on it. Later that week, Sam sent Dean a White Stripes CD. Then Dean sent him a box from Omaha with a dead rat in it. "Dude," Sam's roommate had said, mortified. "I was trying to teach my brother about good music," Sam had explained. His roommate had stared at him in horror. "And you sent him the fucking White Stripes?" It doesn't seem to have made a difference either way, because Dean is still listening to the same tapes he made obsessively on a AA battery-operated boombox that he either A. stole from a Radio Shack in Iowa, or B. stole from a girlfriend who'd set his leather pants on fire. Sam's not sure which, but he still remembers the smell, and the sound of Dean's voice carrying, shouting, "What the fuck are you doing, you crazy motherfucking bitch?" "Is there a particular reason you're so invested in bad hair metal?" Sam asks. "Okay, we prefer the term cock rock, freak," Dean tells him. "Is that the royal we?" Sam rolls his eyes. "That is the we at least didn't try to mail anybody a copy of the White Stripes we." Sam colors deeply and remembers the halcyon days of emergent emo bands. On his 20th birthday, Dean had sent him a t-shirt with a square image of green grass on it, and in faux advertisement bam boxes, it had written in big letters, "Emo grass, cuts itself." Sam never wore it and used to keep it at the bottom of his wardrobe. It burnt away, like Jessica and the life Sam had made for himself, in the apartment fire. He wonders sometimes if it wasn't easier to leave and run away with Dean because of all the things he doesn't have to ground him there anymore. There weren't any books to pack, any CDs to separate out. All the shimmers of their old life together are ashes and sparks, and Sam is free in the worst way. It always hurts the most at twilight, when the sky is blue and pink and purple, a wash of Tijuana colors. Sam looks at that pale bruised pink, and thinks about the skin on Jess's eyelids, the delicate red of it with thin blue veins, how her lashes shuddered and moved as she slept, how she kicked away from him, her body in open parentheses, like she was about to add another detail with her long arms and legs, her tangled blonde hair. Sam has been angry and miserable, shipwrecked and nauseated. Sam has rolled left and right on a disagreeable line of thought. Sam has lost, and he's found, and Sam has stopped waking up with tears on his face. Sam will always miss Jess, not because he thinks that they had so little time together, but because of all the things they could have been. It's not just the hugeness of the absence that stings, but the enormity of possibility. Loss is a finite space, but the future is limitless in scope.
"Dude, cut it out," Dean says suddenly and hits Sam, rough and with knuckles into Sam's collarbone, where it will leave a mark and maximize pain.
"Ow, fuck!" Sam yells and scowls, rubbing his chest. "What the fuck?"
Dean glares. "Seriously, Sam? I can see the smoke coming out of your ears. If there's something going on, just talk about it."
"I thought you said no chick flick moments," Sam says disagreeably. He doesn't think he can ever talk to Dean about Jess, about how he feels not having her. It's not that Dean wouldn't understand. It's that Dean has been telling Sam his whole life why he and Dad burned like this, killing themselves to kill the thing that got Mom, and Sam has always thought they were the biggest motherfucking morons on the face of the earth. He can't think of anything worse than saying to Dean, "Okay, I get it now. Finally, I get it now." Because there's no apology large enough to make Dean understand that Sam has learned, that Sam knows now, that he's sorry he fought them when this was what they were fighting inside their own heads.
Any chick flick moment can automatically be referenced by a manly cock joke or frequent use of the word fuck or nuts, Dean explains. Go.
"I was thinking how fucking nuts you are," Sam tells him facetiously. Dean scowls.
"Nastiest truck stop we see, I'm peddling your ass for gas money."
And if Jessica was an additional detail, then Dean is a hanging clause, a half-finished thought dissolved by ellipses before the punchline. Sam knows Dean better than anybody, and it makes Sam's head hurt to think about Dean, wrapped up in layer after layer of secrets. During Sam's freshman year of college, Sam, A, worked for 2 days at the student paper. B, met Agatha, who introduced him to Derek, who used to date Jess. C, read Light in August and hated it. D, read The Republic and hated it. E, read The History of the Standard Oil Company and hated it. F, got into a fight with Dean that lasted for more than an hour, and when he hung up, he... G, threw up everything he had eaten for 2 days, and hid in bed for 2 days, because he knew like he had always just known things that Dean would never forgive him, and he'd just lost his brother and he'd be alone forever. Lying in bed, gasping into his pillow and wishing he could die or kill Dean or turn back time, or hating his father and how they'd been forced to grow up, Sam had felt like somebody was reaching into his chest, hollowing it out, scraping out all the skin and blood and bone with stubby nails. Sam knew of demons who could do that, and he made a circle of salt, a very small one, around his dorm room bed and waited for it to pass, for something to come. It took going to Stanford for Sam to realize that more than ghosts and demons and poltergeists, he should have always been afraid of himself. During what is supposed to be his senior year of college, Sam, A, drives 3 times cross-country with his brother, B, punches 6 truckers along the way who think Dean is a hooker, C, develops some ESP, it's not a big deal, D, watches Dean get beat up, E, watches Dean dying, it is a big fucking deal, F, gets in a fight with Dean that lasts the entire stretch of road between Boulder, Colorado and the first rest stop in South Dakota, where they find an honest-to-God elk and forget all about how they fucking hate each other. G, watches as his brother throws up everything he has eaten for 2 days in South Carolina, and lets Sam put cool motel tells on his forehead as he mutters, "Goddamn cheese grits," and "botulism." Later that night, when Sam is listening to Dean's deep, even breathing from the next bed, he thinks that if going to Stanford taught him to be afraid of himself, Being back on the road has taught Sam to be afraid for Dean. Sam sits up and watches Dean sleep, and thinks that eventually they will run out of interstate and reasons to keep running from the hugeness of absence behind them, from the enormity of lost possibility, and that when it happens, it will be, for the first time ever, Sam saving Dean, Sam helping Dean, Sam teaching Dean how to do this thing. The car stops at a crossroads, and Sam thinks he sees an honest-to-God tumbleweed there so far out of civilization. Dean moans and whines and strokes the Impala, coaxing it and saying things like, "Baby, why you gotta be like this?" and "I give you the good oil, don't I?" When Sam suggests that maybe the car has run its course, Dean gives him a look like Sam just hit a toddler with a crowbar and covers the hood of the car protectively, like the Impala is Sam's next victim. "Dude," Dean says seriously. Sam rolls his eyes. "It's an old car, Dean." "The term is distinguished, you bitch," Dean hisses. "Whatever," Sam snaps. "We're distinguished in bumfuck nowhere." Dean says they're still in South Carolina, and Sam wouldn't believe him if it weren't for the enormous billboard a few hundred yards ahead, with screaming yellow letters spelling out, "Done touring beautiful South Carolina? See Savannah, Georgia. City of the past. City of the future." Sam bites his lip. "It's a sign," he hisses. "Don't you see?" Dean stares at him from where he's crouched near the front of the car, frowning at the underbody. "Of course it's a sign, you fucking retard," he says. "No, I meant, like, it's a sign," Sam argues, scowling. "City of the future?" Dean rolls his eyes so hard Sam can feel it from 3 feet away, and Sam glares darkly before he says, "We should go to Savannah." The smirk that appears on Dean's face is enough to make him regret saying it out loud, no matter how much he feels it's true, no matter how much it's been singing underneath his skin since they left that truck stop in North Carolina. "I'm serious," Sam insists. "You know that ESP you've been making fun of me about?" "Oh, you are not using your Miss Cleo powers for evil instead of good already, are you, Sammy?" Dean laughs. "The point is," Sam soldiers on, glaring darkly, "is that something is telling me we should go to Savannah. My instincts haven't been wrong so far, Dean. I really think we should do this." Dean groans. "Oh, man, you can't play that card on me. That's just wrong." "What card?" Sam asks, genuinely confused. "The I'm so earnest card," Dean sighs, raising his eyebrows. "I don't have an I'm so earnest card," Sam lies, and furrows his brow earnestly. Dean purses his lips. "Yeah, I don't believe you as far as I could throw your beanpole ass. And anyway, we're not going anywhere anytime soon, since the cars..." Which is the exact moment when the engine of the Impala rolls over, purring low and sweet and satisfied, like a cat or a lover, and Dean boggles at it, eyes huge, and Sam cannot help but think that he hears something in the air, high and sweet like a laugh, muffled through a wall. They stop at a motel in Beaufort County with a diner attached. It's dinner time and it's packed, men in work boots and women in office clothes, bright, primary-colored sweaters with applique flowers and kittens on them, teenaged girls in jeans and tight t-shirts. And all of their voices are soothing and sweet and roll over Sam like a comforting wave. He forgot, after all that time in California, how sweet it was to hear English with all its syllables elongated, to hear it spoken in the South, lazy and lingering. A few of the overhead lights have blown and the diner is orangey with dim light, and the clatter and bang of food being prepared in the back is overwhelmed by all the voices, so when Sam and Dean slip into the last open booth, they barely hear themselves move, just feel the worn plastic of the seats, the rough edges of the linoleum on the table.
"Don't fuck with my car anymore, Sam," Dean warns, reaching for a menu stuffed behind the ketchup and pepper.
Sam blinks. "I didn't do anything to your car," he protests. Dean narrows his eyes.
"You fucked with my car until I agreed to go to Savannah." The girls in the booth behind Dean are giggling, darting curious glances and whispering to each other, pointing at Dean's back and muffling chatter. All his life, Sam's watched girls in small towns and strange cities fall instantly for the person they think Dean is. "You're completely nuts," Sam informs him, and snatches the other menu, scanning his options. He's hungry, though he doesn't know how to put his finger on exactly what he wants. He thinks, rubbed sage, and doesn't know why. Sam's never eaten anything with rubbed sage in it, but he remembers smelling it once, how it felt like a green sneeze in his nose. "Don't even start with me, Sam," Dean says, and orders a patty melt with fries when a blonde and unremarkable waitress comes over, order pad already in hand, and says, "What'll y'all be having?" Dean points at Sam for emphasis. "Also, do not start with me about the food." "You know I'm just going to laugh and laugh when you weigh 600 pounds, Sam says, handing the waitress a yellowing laminated menu and ordering the blue plate special. She bites her lip and doesn't hide her smile before she turns back toward the counter. "I'm sorry, Sam," Dean says sincerely. "I wasn't aware that while I wasn't paying attention, I turned into one of the contestants on America's Next Top Model." He opens his eyes hugely. "Quick, check my makeup." Sam shoves at his shoulder and snaps, "You have to stop watching bad TV at laundry places." "Beggars can't be choosers," Dean tells him easily, and pulls out the laptop. Sam has watched Dean watch the Newlywed Show and talk about how it's nice that Nick and Jessica are making it against all odds. Sam doesn't have the heart to update Dean on their latest developments. It's one of those strange, surprising things Sam has always known about Dean, but has forgotten he was privy to. How Dean loves family, wants a home, values all these things more than almost anybody who has ever had one. Sam remembers how he started to take Jess for granted, how he took his mailing address for granted. In Stanford, Sam had a mailbox, and all Dean has ever known is his post office box number. But in a lot of ways, Dean has always been older than his years, ever since he ran out of their burning house with Sam clutched in his arms. He's decided to make the best of it, even when the best of it's bad. Sam used to hate him for this. Sam wishes now he'd appreciated it as a teenager. It was never fair for Dean to have to balance between their father and his brother and drift like the ghosts they hunted between two very different worlds. Dean spends most of the time waiting for their food, siphoning off a wandering wireless connection to look up oracles in Savannah, and Sam spends that time not so discreetly watching Dean work. Dean doesn't seem to mind. Sam's spent most of his life watching Dean in one way or another, and Dean is used to being watched. "You're not freaked out by this?" Sam asks suddenly. He reaches out to start stacking the plastic and foil packages of Smucker's apple and grape jelly, in bright, unnatural colors. In the 7th grade, his team, composed of Jim, Anna, Chang, and Derek, once won a bridge-building contest. It was made out of popsicle sticks and glue and held up 3 bricks before crumbling. "By what?" Dean mumbles, his eyes darting left to right across the laptop screen. Sam stares at the jelly packets and starts to stack them, like ballasts or foundations, and wonders if he can use the coffee straws as slats for a flat surface. It's like 7th grade again, and he's trying to talk to his older brother over breakfast because Dad hasn't come home yet. Sam shrugs and watches his hands as he says, "By my, you know, my thing." Dean looks up, his face pulling a tortured expression. "Sam, you do realize that when I had the talk with you in 6th grade, those things I said about your privates apply to all boys, right?" Dean asks. "I wasn't talking about that," Sam snaps, and throws an apple jelly at Dean. Dean likes apple jelly, which is hilarious because he hates most apples since his stint in the orchard of pagan murdering scarecrows. "Jesus, all right," Dean says, flipping the jelly packet between his fingers. "You mean you're tapping to the Miss Cleo line?" "We are coming up with a new name for it," Sam tells him fiercely. "No, Sam, I'm not particularly freaked out," Dean answers finally and raises his eyebrows. "Are you worried about it?" Sam looks at the remaining three jelly ballasts and reaches for the coffee straws. In a chipped blue mug, snug next to the condiment caddy, mottled with fingerprints of the hundreds of people who have eaten here in this ambient noise and food smell before.
No, Sam lies. Because you look so relaxed about it, Dean says sarcastically.
Sam hears the sound of fingers flying over keys again, and he looks up, momentarily infuriated that Dean is going to let Sam keep feeling bad with such little fight. And he knows the second he does that he's been faked out, because Dean's eyes flick toward him and they are clear and warm and comforting. He says,
"We talked about this, Sammy. Nothing's going to happen to you as long as I'm here."
It makes Sam color all over because Dean's right. He is being a moron. This is just another sign and wonder in a long series of them he's been seeing and ignoring his whole life. And when the waitress brings their food, they talk about oracles and Greek mythology, about the power and mystery around these women of Delphi.
"I don't think they migrated," Dean says reasonably.
"I love how you can believe in everything except for fortune tellers," Sam scoffs.
"Fortune telling is crap," Dean reminds him.
He looks at his cell phone warily, and Sam has a sudden flash of Missouri calling about her shouting into Dean's ear as Sam laughs.
"Scared, Dean?" Sam teases.
"No,"
Dean sneers.
"Excuse me," the waitress says, and when Dean and Sam look up at her, she smiles nervously and hands them a postcard. She says, "I just remembered as I was doing up your bill. Your auntie sent this by post a few days ago, said you'd be stopping by with us. We've been holding on to it for you." Her hands and the fake pink nails at the tips of her fingers sparkle as she makes a fluttering gesture. "They're real sweet old ladies, it seems. Been calling for days."
Sam blinks. "Excuse me?"
Dean kicks him under the table and flashes the waitress a smile.
"Thanks, Karina," he says,
because Dean always knows the name of the waitress. It's one of those observational skills Sam has never managed to pick up.
"You drive safe down to him," Karina tells Dean with a smirk. She's nearing 40 and looks 10 years older than that, sagging under the weight of her life. But Sam thinks she's interesting, with pulled-back brown hair and red lips, shiny from lipstick. She waves and wanders off to the register. Sam and Dean stare at the postcard where it sits on the table between them. On the back, it reads, "You boys hurry up now. Peach season is almost over. And do not, I repeat, do not be stopping off on the shoulder where Billy's Girls Go-Go is." Dean reaches over to turn the postcard, and on the other side, it's a glossy tourist photo of Savannah, green and lush with life underneath a big blue sky. The blocky text in the right-hand corner reads, "Savannah, it's in your future."
"Now I'm freaked out," Dean tells Sam vehemently the next morning.
They were shattered out of sleep earlier that day by a wake-up call put in by those same aunties. The ladies at the desk reminded them to get on the road quick, and they'd make Savannah by evening.
"Now I am very freaked out," Dean repeats.
"I am also freaked out," Sam agrees.
"I am freaked out, and I may never be able to eat peaches again," Dean declares. "Which fucking sucks, because I like peaches."
"Peaches are a very delicious fruit," Sam says, "because what the hell else do you say when you're being stalked psychically by three old women in Savannah?" On the right side of the road, Sam sees an enormous billboard for Billy's Girls Go-Go. Dean stares at it, an expression of torn defiance and longing on his features, and all Sam can think is that of course Dean wants to go to a sleazy strip joint just to fuck with oracles. Of course Dean wants to fuck with oracles. Kings and generals did not fuck with oracles back in the golden era of ancient Greece, and Dean wants to see a few flashes of fake breast just to hack them off. Sam can't believe he's been sitting in a car Dean is driving for more than 10 years now.
"We're not going," Sam says preemptively.
"What, you're gonna let three old ladies scare us?" Dean scoffs, but he stays in his lane.
Sam raises his eyebrows at Dean. "I've been scared by much less. Also, I get the impression that if we go, there'll just be another postcard waiting for us at the front desk."
"They have front desks at strip joints?" Dean asks inanely, fingers tapping on the wheel.
He is jittery, and Sam doesn't blame him. Neither of them has ever savored the mystery of things. The mystery is usually where the large, angry, malevolent spirits hide.
You would know, Sam snaps back.
I've never needed to pay for it, Dean tells him proudly.
Why pay when you can download it for free? Sam mutters before the thought properly makes it through his brain-to-mouth filter, and Dean bursts into uproarious laughter, slapping his hand on the dash and saying, I knew you wanted to go to college for the porn, until they edge out of Beaufort County and into Jasper.
The winter Sam was 14, he spent it mostly alone in a ramshackle house on the Outer Banks, nursing his broken foot and hobbling down through the icy, unforgiving beach winds to Pete's Grocery, the only thing on the island open year-round. Every Monday afternoon, he bought 5 boxes of Kraft mac and cheese and a couple of cans of fruit, some popcorn and hot chocolate, bacon and eggs and milk and cereal, and carried them home in a plastic bag with a Have a Nice Day in green on the side above a smiley face. It was lonely and miserable, and all things considered, exactly what Sam needed. A winter of stillness, staring out at the ocean, licking away at the beach with gray, hungry waves. Sam got exactly 8 postcards that winter, each from Dean and filled with encouragement for Sam to lose his virginity and experiment with narcotic substances. Each time he found one in the mailbox of the rental, it had felt so incongruous with the overcast sea blues and grays of the beach, like a sudden burst of summer, like a vivid flash of warmth, because postcards are for sunshine and sunglasses. That winter, Dean and their father drove through 16 states, and Sam still aches a little, thinking about how it was just another in a long list of things he was never a part of. Dean might think of Sam as the good child, the fair-haired boy, but Sam has always known the truth. Dean is a storybook of people who have loved him too well. Sam still has all 8 of the cards, each dotted with Dean's laconic scrawl, neat despite himself, and Sam remembers divining hidden meaning out of the way Dean dotted his I's and crossed his T's. Sam remembers trying to read his brother from very far away, and only seeing the reality of Dean like a blurry suggestion through a veil, and hating it. He remembers thinking it was like losing a limb, like moving a part of his body that wasn't there anymore, and being surprised every time he had opened his eyes and Dean hadn't been breathing quietly on the other side of the room. When they reach Savannah, it is syrupy slick with suffocating condensation. Trees are drooping under the weight of their lush green leaves, and Sam swears he hears the sidewalks burn, a low, sulking hiss beneath the singing sweet tones of Southern American English coloring the air.
Savannah's America's most haunted city, Dean says offhanded.
Sam blinks at him.
Really? He asks, surprised.
Dean shrugs.
I mean, apparently somebody thinks so, he comments mildly, and squints his eyes against the searing orange glare of sunset.
Sam looks ahead, but from his angle, he sees thick, dreamlike purple and luminous pink floating in the sky like layers in a tropical cocktail, fringed in the dark outlines of leaves.
Did the oracles maybe specify where in Savannah they wanted us so desperately? Dean asks, rolling his eyes and annoyed.
Sam sighs.
Oracles aren't known for their specificity. Okay, yes, Dean concedes. But that was like 6 billion years ago in Greece. This is modern-day U.S. of A. If these fuckers don't have a phone number and a mailing address, then I'm getting back on 95 to kill some two-headed alligators.
Is there anything at all supernatural about the two-headed alligator? Sam demands.
Maybe, Dean says defensively.
Oh my god, you're seriously 14 years old, Sam accuses. Dean screws up his face belligerently, like he's about to launch into a carefully thought-out thesis on why Sam's a douchebag, when a half-naked hobo rushes out in front of their car, and Dean shouts, Jesus fucking Christ! And slams on the brakes instead. After Dean finishes cussing and stroking the Impala and checking her brakes and cussing some more, Sam asks the hobo what the hell that was all about, and he gives them a toothless grin before passing along a delicate pale lavender envelope. He says, Y'all are late, and disappears again with a flash of his dirty, sweaty back.
"This is officially no longer funny," Dean fumes, and snatches the envelope out of Sam's hands to break the delicate white candle wax seal.
The carefully folded sheet of stationery Dean pulls out smells like magnolia perfume, and it reads,
"Dear Brothers Winchester, we are excited about our imminent meeting. We extend our apologies over Dean's recent health crisis. We suggested a diet of soda water and saltines for that stretch of the road, but the postcard was unfortunately lost by its bearer through absent-mindedness. But are grateful to see you have finally arrived. Drive straight from here, then take your first 6 lefts, then your first 6 rights, and stop at the house with the magnolia grove. Affectionately, Violet Rose Hyacinth."
Dean says, "Dude, what the fuck?"
And Sam thinks that pretty much captures his feelings on the subject, too. The house with a magnolia grove, as it turns out, is a sprawling antebellum plantation house with a magnolia grove, thick and white and frothy with blossoms. They smell, from the roll-down windows of the Impala, like perfume off a woman's wrist, sweet and indistinct, like skin and air. As they creep closer down a gravel dirt road, through the mist of green leaves and white foam of flowers, the brown fingers of branches, Dean starts squinting into the distance, through the deepening evening. Sam has lost the "you need glasses" and "no, I fucking do not, Sammy" fight every single time he has picked it with Dean, which is approximately 6,040,000,000 and counting. Sam can't decide if it's physical vanity or Dean's unwillingness to express anything less than perfect aim, though his experience has more than carried him through the difference all of these years. When Sam was a sophomore at Stanford, and during one of the many reiterations of this fight, he, in desperation, told Dean guys in glasses were sexy, so there is a slight chance that Dean knows that Sam was a little gay then, too.
"Holy shit," Dean breathes. Sam blinks.
From behind the veil of flowers and sweeping fingers of enormous willow trees, bowing on either side of the lane and oaks, limbs heavy with green, curvy round leaves, appears a house painted a sunny creamy yellow with a large wraparound porch covered in crawling vines and blooming flowers in a riot of purple and white. Their green fingers and leaves wind around fat columns, undecidedly Ionic or Doric, rising 2 stories upward to a ballast and balcony with a white-toothed railing and windows running floor to ceiling along the second story. And a Spanish red brick makes up an arched doorway over a green gate, in front of which Dean eases the car to a slow, docile stop, and they stare at the ghostly moss that grows over everything, like a layer of living spider webs, huge and ghostly, as the pink flushes out of the sky at last, and darkness creeps in, starshine edging the pointed roof, the gabled window, the ocean of trees behind the house.
"I think I saw this in a movie once," Sam says quietly. For some reason, he doesn't want to break the stillness, but that's fine. He and Dean have always been able to be quiet together. "Dude, I know I saw this place in a movie once," Dean answers softly.
Outside, the moon is creeping from behind a blush of clouds, and Sam looks at the angles and curves of Dean's face as he leans against the steering wheel, staring up into the sky through the window of the Impala. Sometimes, Sam thinks about how Dean only really knows the world from the Impala's windows, and that Dean deserves better than the metal boxing him in.
"Place looks abandoned," Dean says, and adds, "sort of."
The grass is wild and overgrown up close, a crush of green, with elegant wrought iron chairs and tables, made in elaborate, painstaking whirls, overturned in the pygmy jungle of weeds and dandelions. Sam wonders what this house looked like before whoever loved it had gone.
"Are you sure you want to do this?" Dean asks nervously.
"Are we rehashing how you're scared of little old ladies again?" Sam asks with a wry grin.
"No,"
Dean hisses defensively, and even in the dim moon, Sam can see the flush on his cheeks.
"I'm just saying the place looks pretty abandoned."
"They gave us explicit directions," Sam argues, and unbuckles his seatbelt. Dean's eyes get huge. In a freaking letter handed to us by a naked homeless guy. Sam shrugs. So their messaging system is a little buggy, he allows generously, and reaches across Dean's lap to pop his seatbelt, ignoring Dean's dirty look as he does it. Now come on, if we make them wait too long, they could get pissed. If possible, Dean's eyes get even larger, and he all but scrambles out of the car, muttering about the naked homeless pony express, and how he can't believe he's getting punked like this. Their boots crunch over gravel and make hard clapping noises against the groaning, protesting wood of the wide front steps, and Sam holds his breath as they fall into place next to one another at the front door, paint peeling and knob worn and worn-in brass. There's a porch swing swaying slowly front to back, the chains creaking like a low wail in the night, and Sam wishes everything about this moment wasn't so terribly eerie, wishes he didn't feel like he was about to step into the parlor at the invitation of a creature with spindly limbs and bright eyes. Oh, now who's scared? Dean hisses, with all the maturity of a sixth grader, and Sam wrinkles his nose, gathering up his courage to knock on the door, his fists barely brushing the tired wood before the door sweeps open. Samuel Jefferson Winchester, says a woman in a lavender-embroidered robe, buttoned tight to a lacy collar, framing a round and rosy face with hazy eyes. You will wipe that expression off your face immediately, or you will not cross my threshold. Is that understood? Sam opens his mouth, eyebrows knitting together at the force of her voice and the white cloudiness of her eyes. Don't be dull, Samuel. Of course I'm blind. That doesn't make me stupid. Now close your mouth. Dean, because he can't help himself, snickers. Now don't you start, Dean Jensen, she says reproachfully. For somebody who nearly died from a bad plate of cheese grits, you do not have the higher ground. Dean scowls as Sam smirks. Man, Dean mutters. You're both late, she tells them matter-of-factly, looking between the two of them with unseeing eyes. And you'll both be wanting something to eat. Lord, the woman sighs. Goodness knows Rose is already up in the kitchen, stewing up a feast. Dean brightens at that, smile bursting across his face, and he looks at Sam, saying, Okay, so I think we're gonna like it here. The woman laughs and reaches over, patting Dean's arm affectionately as she says, Now, do y'all boys have your things? Sam says, What, you can't tell? The woman actually hits him upside the head, honey brown bangs flying everywhere, and Sam yells, Hey! Maligned, even as Dean doubles over laughing, as she says disapprovingly, Samuel, I speak to the higher forces. The higher forces do not care for your luggage. Oh, yeah, Dean chokes out. I'm gonna like it here. I'll go get our stuff, Sam mutters, and as he stomps down the porch again, he hears Dean say, all molasses, sweet and charm. Ma'am? Right. Violet, I won't hear a word of it. You couldn't be a day over 19. Rose and Hyacinth are twin sisters, and have matching brown eyes, bright like the sea stones Sam remembers plucking from the North Carolina beach, sheer and gleaming in the depressed off-season sun, faint in the overpowering gray of the ocean. Hyacinth sits quietly at a corner of the table and watches them with solemn interest as Rose pushes out of the kitchen chair and rushes it straight toward Sam. Rose, when Sam meets her, peers at Sam carefully, looks into his eyes and narrows her own until she seems to see something that satisfies her. Her expression goes affectionate and surrendered, and Sam almost takes a step back when she reaches for him, when she closes her papery soft palm over his hands and gives him a smile. She feeds Sam and Dean sweet yellow squares of cornbread, crumbling soft in their hands, and Dean sops up the gravy from her pot roast with it, moaning extravagantly around every bite while Rose laughs silently, her whole body shaking from it. Violet shakes her head. She says, Lord almighty, those sounds, you Winchester boy. Even Hyacinth, silent in her corner, smiles benevolently, closes a hand over her mouth, but not before Sam sees a flash of perfect, shockingly white teeth. This is why, Sam thinks,
watching his brother overact and preen and shine, that people love Dean so well. He is delightful. He makes people delirious. Crazy, Sam used to complain, in the back seat during long car trips across the lazy sprawl of the Midwest. Dean is driving me completely crazy. Dean is like Urgot, and Sam feels, like he's always felt, a little different, out of context, closely examined. Nobody has ever made Sam so happy and angry and frustrated and insane as Dean, so Sam has spent his whole life seeking equilibrium, a place that would be far enough from his brother not to be rocked by him. His second year at Stanford, he realized it was all in his own head. 2 decades of Dean letting Sam have his way, giving Sam what he wanted, letting Sam have what he needed, be it the last of the cereal or to be far away from Dean. It has left Sam colored in. "They've been worried sick about you too, you know," Violet tells Sam finally, as Dean strikes up an animated conversation with Rose, who can't talk, and Hyacinth, who can't hear. Sam blushes. "We got caught up."
"Oh, we knew," Violet says airily. "We were worried about your poor brother. I didn't think a human being could throw up that much."
"Neither did Dean," Sam laughs.
"Lord," Violet sighs. "If those women knew we were talking about vomiting at the dinner table."
Dean, who has offered Rose his hand and is being taught how to sign his own name, isn't paying attention, and neither are the twins, who are laughing at Dean's shocking lack of dexterity. Sam remembers learning how to sign his name in college during some sort of diversity week. Jess had been under a white tent and he'd followed her in, and she'd said, "Look, Sam, it's your name." And he'd watched a woman move her narrow-fingered hands like a bird. Sam is finally caught watching Dean when he catches Violet watching him, and unrepentantly, she says, "It's far past time you slept, boys. Tomorrow is a long day." Dean asks, "Long how?" "It's harvest time in the orchard, you know," Violet lectures, and starts to clear the plates. "And none of our other hands are here."
"They're beasts," Dean says bitterly, pulling his t-shirt up to rub the sweat dripping down his face.
"I'll go with that," Sam agrees, collapsing in the shade of a peach tree, near drunk with the dizzy sweet smell of peaches and scalding afternoon heat.
Sam swears he can hear things sizzling in the distance, the sound of the asphalt and tar melting, grass wilting, the slight hiss of water evaporating up into a perfect white cloud sky. Sam has stripped off his bedraggled mess of a shirt and rolled up his khaki pants. Dean is barefoot in the hot, brittle earth, and his short sleeves are rolled up, the legs of his pants rolled so he looks like a woman in a rice paddy, bending over a bushel basket of fruit and picking through to find the most perfect of them. Dean has eaten, at Sam's count, at least 4 of them, juice running sticky sweet down his chin and on his neck, getting his hands tacky with dirt, and all the insects are drawn to him, fascinated by this new and strangely unpetaled flower in the orchard.
"Slave drivers," Dean says, but without any venom, flopping down cross-legged next to Sam and still peering into the baskets.
"Yes," he exclaims, and reaches in carefully, smoothing his hands over the softly furred curves of the fruit.
"Careful now, the spirits might tell on you," Sam warns, grinning. Dean holds baseballs and class goldfish, escaped from their bowls, and peaches all the same way, delicately, and Sam can almost hear Dean saying, "It's fine, Sammy, see, it's fine." Dean is always careful with Sam, and so Sam has never learned how to be careful with Dean.
"Ha," Dean mutters, cupping the peach in his hand. It is, Sam admits, perfect, a glorious shy cream in yellow and pale pink color, luscious and coy. Sam thinks that if there is a debutante among fruits, then it would be the Georgia peach.
"The spirits have plenty to tell on me for, not including anything I've said this afternoon."
"It's only picking."
"It's only picking," Dean mimics. "It's also only like 100 degrees out here."
It's too hot for Sam to argue with Dean, so he just leans back against the trunk of a tree and thinks to himself that no orchard that looks so small should take so much time to harvest. Sam swears that he'll never again listen to Dean's whims about finding oracles, and should they come calling, they will turn right around and run away. "Stop complaining," Sam tells Dean finally. "You could use the workout." He says it mostly to make Dean yell, "What?" and "Are you kidding?" And so he'll pull up his t-shirt and entertain himself by sucking in his gut and talking about his rippling abdominals. Sam closes his eyes and smiles, leans his head back against the tree, until he hears Violet shouting for them over the green lace of the tree line, calling them in to lunch. Dean forgives the three fates immediately, moaning again around double-breaded fried chicken and collards stewed with ham hock, mashed potatoes with mushroom gravy. He says, I really couldn't eat another thing. Until Rose smiles indulgently at him and brings out the peach cobbler, still sunshiny warm from sitting in the bushel baskets Sam and Dean had hauled in that morning. Then Sam is reduced to monosyllabic extravagant noises too, mouthfuls of brown sugar and oatmeal crumble top. There are syrupy sweet peaches, almost fizzy, and with a slight bite that Violet explains with a wink and a whispered, "Brandy." And Dean is certainly drunk with it, Sam thinks later, biting his lip hard to keep from laughing, when he finds Dean asleep beneath an enormous walnut tree, a NASCAR 2000 hat pulled over his face, and a bristle of unshaved whiskers glimmering in the afternoon light on his chin. Sam is sitting on the back porch of the house, rocking himself on the porch swing with a foot on the porch railing, his fingers going numb around a mint julep with fresh mint floating on the lip of the glass, and he has been watching Dean sleep and scrub lazily at his stomach for the past hour, wondering why they are here and where they will go after, if this isn't another thing that was always meant to happen. Sam thinks that he hasn't seen Dean this relaxed and happy in ages, since before Sam went away to college. He thinks of Dean on hazy hot afternoons on the banks of rivers and lakes, Dean reclining on the bed of Dad's truck, Dean looking around wherever they were until he saw Sam again.
"Samuel, will you stop that rocking for a moment so an old blind woman can sit down?" Violet says suddenly, and Sam nearly wrenches his knee, jumping to comply. She laughs at him as Sam complains, making clucking, soothing noises in between her teasing, and saying,
"Now you've learned your lesson, haven't you, Brother Winchester?"
"Yeah, something like that," Sam says sullenly, rubbing at his knee.
Violet settles in, and Sam feels the worn gingham cloth of her skirt on his legs, next to his knee, and feels suddenly self-conscious, caught.
"That brother of yours," Violet says quietly, "that brother of yours, quite a remarkable boy."
"That's Dean," Sam says.
"He took care of you when you were a baby," Violet says, musing. "He was your big brother, and you were his baby."
"I was his baby brother," Sam corrects.
"No, Sam," Violet says gently. "You were his baby. He was always taking care of you."
Sam lets her murmur because he doesn't know what to add. It's true. Sam has always been Dean's baby, Dean's responsibility, Dean's.
"That's right," Sam thinks. "That's right."
Sam sees Hyacinth come up to them, tiny padding steps, shuffling in worn slippers. She leans against the porch railing, where Sam's shoe had been before, and watches them, watches Sam more. She always looks distressed and wary when she looks at Sam, and Sam wonders what he's done to her, if he said something, if she's figured him out, if she doesn't agree.
"You've grown now, Samuel," Violet says, like she's reminding him.
"I know that," Sam tells her, looking at her strangely before looking to Hyacinth. She seems worried, the brown-lined curves of her face sagging tiredly in the afternoon light.
"Of course I know that."
"Good, good," Violet says to him. "Now go." She puts a hand on Sam's knee.
"Go get that brother of yours out of the sun. He's going to look like a lobster if he stays out any longer."
Once Sam fetches Dean out of the sun, drags his still sleepy brother into the house, where Rose and Hyacinth and even Violet fuss over him,
and Dean finds himself tumbled eventually into an enormous eyelet-covered bed, blindingly white and cloud-like. Sam sits on the edge of the bed. It smells like bright new sunshine, and watches Dean fall asleep again, undisturbed by Sam's gaze, because Sam has always watched Dean. To Dean, this is breathing in and out. And suddenly Sam is so happy that he can't care that the oracles haven't answered the question he hasn't asked, that they seem to have predicted everything except how this will end. Even if Sam doesn't have his mother, and has never really had his father, even if Sam lost Jess, Sam will have his brother. Yeah, Sam says to himself and the quiet sound of Dean's even breathing. It's true. It's Hyacinth, finally, who draws Sam away, tiptoes into the room and tugs at Sam's elbow, pulls him into the hallway where the warm orange lights from the sunset are melting the floors golden red. Sam feels caught again, a little embarrassed, and Hyacinth, her unopened mouth still mobile, looks more worried than ever, wringing her hands. It's fine, Sam tells her, but he thinks he knows he's lying. On the third day, after they have forgotten all about the contrary nature of oracles, Sam and Dean come in with the last of the peaches late in the soggy hot day. That night, in the velvety dark, Violet serves tea and Dean helps Rose serve ginger cookies on the back porch, orange kitchen light spilling across the worn white wooden planks. Hyacinth worries more, sits in an enormous rattan chair and frets, hands smoothing over a set of worn tarot cards in her lap. Cool, Dean decides, handing Hyacinth a fragile, gold-flecked china dish of cookies, brittle and cool with a wonderful snap. Read my fortune. Hyacinth raises one beautifully arched brow at him, and slaps Dean's hand away when he makes to reach for her cards, and Rose and Violet both burst into laughter at Dean's betrayed expression, as if he is no longer the favored child. Hey, Dean says feelingly. Now Hyacinth doesn't know a thing about telling silly fortunes with those cards, Violet supplies, sipping delicately at her tea. She just plays with them when she's nervous. Sam stares. Hyacinth stares back, even as she lays out the deck, in the practiced hands of a woman who knows the hidden language of the tarot cards. Sam wonders if Violet is lying, or if Hyacinth has, all these years. If these oracles are like Merlin, able to see everyone's fate but their own, or if they're jealous and petty gods, with knowledge they won't share. They've been here for 3 days now, and in between Dean's laughter and the food, Sam all but forgot what he was here for, that there had been a question hidden beneath his tongue. Rose puts a hand on Sam's knee, and when Sam looks at her, she is smiling faintly at him. What? Dean asks, and when Sam turns to look, he sees Dean looking baffled as Hyacinth takes his hand and Rose takes the other. It's time, you brothers Winchester, Violet says gently, and she closes her eyes, closing her palm over Sam's as he feels his free fingers twined with Rose's, paper soft. And then Savannah disappears. When they wake up, hours, hours on hours later, when all the tea is cold and the cookies are stale, and the night has darkened the state again, their bodies ache and Sam has tears on his face, and Dean is still moaning into Violet's comforting arms, eyes shut violently as his shoulders shake. But before Sam can yell, "What the fuck are you doing to my brother?" Violet looks up at Sam, her blind eyes piercing, and freezes him in place. What's wrong with... He's fine, Violet murmurs to Sam, over the top of Dean's hair. He's just tired. I'm fine, Dean says. There's something in my eye. You are not goddamn fine, Sam says, but he's still leaning against the porch, too weak to move or make fun of Dean for crying like a pussy and falling to the ground. They are on their knees on the back porch of a plantation house in Savannah, where 3 women have showed them, in a whirlwind of suggestions and images and a searing pain in Sam's arm, his shoulder, down his entire left side, the future that is now only a deepening blur of darkness. It's close enough that Sam remembers sounds, a smell, a feeling. It is elusive, this memory that is fading with every second, and Sam wonders hatefully at the nature of the future, if you can't hold on to it, if you can't learn from it or plan for it, or if that isn't the point, that no matter how you try to circumvent your fate, you'll just find an alternate path, another way to wander into the same fire to which you were due, no matter how far or fast you run.
"But I don't remember," Sam argues, weak and wobbling. He can hear his voice waver. I don't know what we saw. I don't know what we'll do.
"You'll do what you need to," Violet says, and Sam turns to see Rose and Hyacinth huddled together, murmuring soundlessly into each other's ears, stroking each other's arms, and feels a momentary ache so deep and empty. He reaches out, strokes his fingers over the back of Dean's palm to feel the imperfect brown skin of his brother's hand, and to know that he is there.
"Do we win?" Dean asks, and he is hoarse, his voice muffled in Violet's shoulder.
Violet smiles at Sam, over Dean's head, like they are sharing a secret. And Sam knows, suddenly, exactly what she means. How could they ever fail with Dean?
"Of course, Dean Jensen. How could you not?"
"Jesus," Dean says, shaky with realization.
"There'd better be a praise him after that, Dean," Violet warns, and Sam barks a rough laugh, the last broken images of the prophecy disappearing from his grasp.
So he closes his eyes and lets them roll over him, a longing wave, and he sees, in a moment of shocking and utterly perfect clarity, Dean's million-dollar grin, and the shine off an ocean at sunrise, the gray-blue water and tired yellow beach. He hears Dean say, "Good job, little brother," and Sam says, out loud, he thinks, "Thank you. Thanks for everything."
Two days later, after Sam and Dean have sweated the future and the past, and 20 fucking pounds, Dean insists, out of their pores in the syrupy hot of Savannah, they pack up their car, shoving their meager personal items into the trunk and saying reluctant goodbyes.
"No more botulism," Dean says, though he says it politely.
Rose raises an eyebrow at him while Hyacinth rolls her eyes. Violet just ignores him.
"I mean it," Dean insists, though he looks almost watery-eyed to be leaving, despite Violet's invitation for them to return any time, to come back and pick peaches and sleep, undisturbed.
"Thank you," Sam translates, "for everything." It's not a real answer, and there isn't a timeline, but he knows their direction now, that they are doing the right thing in what is maybe the right way. And he looks at Dean and thinks that this is right, too, that he shouldn't be scared anymore. Sam hears dust and gravel crunching beneath his feet, and he thinks about the first time he left, when he'd been so scared and furious and tired of pretending, of moving from place to place and it being an excuse, just another reason to lean on his brother, to look to Dean for any and everything. Sam thought, then, that he had to have distance to breathe, to grow up, to get away, to cut it the fuck out. And now he thinks he knows better. If they've been doing the right thing, then maybe Sam was never wrong. Dean is slipping into the car now, saying loudly, "Get moving, Sammy." And Sam is going toward him, because for the first time in his life, Sam knows what to do and how to get what he wants, and everything finally makes sense. And that is when Violet takes his hand, and Rose and Hyacinth touch his arm, and they all say, as if in the same breath, though it's one voice, whispering in his ear, "He'd do anything for you, but you can't ask him this." Sam stares, horrified, at three pairs of sad eyes, in suddenly matching colors of black, like the inky night when they'd woken up after the reading, like the first time Sam had run away from this, when that is what he'd thought to himself, that Dean would do anything, and he hated himself for even asking the question. Sam swallows hard, around the marble ball in his throat. "But..." "No, Samuel," they say again, six eyes drifting closed. "No, Sam, you can't."
Suddenly it's over, just another flash that never happened,
and Sam finds himself in the front seat of the Impala, Dean fumbling around looking for a mixtape he'd made his senior year and hasn't been able to find since. Dean says, "I know what's in here," he says, "unless you fucking stole it." And when he sees Sam's face, he asks, "You okay?" Sam blinks and breathes and readjusts, feels the edges of his fingers and the surface of his skin again, the hot thread of the sun, a shaft across his knees. "Hey, Sammy," Dean says, firmer this time. Sam realizes that maybe this is what they had wanted him to know from the beginning, that there was never any question of winning or losing, or what they might pay to know. All of this, the diner in North Carolina and the motels along the way, the peaches and the orchard and Violet's measured voice and steady hands.
"You okay?" Dean asks, uncertain.
Sam nods his head. He's always known, anyway. He doesn't know why he thought it would change, that there wouldn't be loss the way he'd lost Jess, or that it wouldn't hurt to let it die. "I'm fine," Sam lies, because even if it isn't, it has to be true. It's fine. Unasked, a supernatural fanfic written by Astolat and read by Applejuice. Pairing, Sam/Dean. Rated explicit. Summary. Sam doesn't ask. Note, this fic is a sequel to It Doesn't Mean You Can Explain the Ocean by Rageproof Rock, and won't make sense without it.
Sam doesn't ask. In Florida, when they burst out of the old collapsing mausoleum into afternoon sunshine, covered with dirt and ectoplasm and victory, and Dean punches his fist in the air and looks at him, dirty and grinning and shining so bright that for a minute Sam almost can't see. Still, he doesn't ask. He doesn't reach out and put his hands on Dean's face, where they belong according to every instinct and yearning he has in him. In Alabama, when Dean's side is slashed down to the bone, white gleam through red flesh in four narrow rows, and Sam has to pour holy water over the cuts and watch them sizzle, Dean's head buried against his thigh and Dean's arms wrapped around him, squeezing breath out of him as Dean pretends he's not screaming into the denim. Sam doesn't bend down and kiss Dean's bare shoulder, doesn't even put his hand on Dean's back like he could maybe get away with. Instead, he says, makes himself say, "You know, Dean, it's okay if you need to cry like a little girl." And Dean says a muffled, "Fuck you," shakily, and Sam puts him to bed alone. In Tennessee, when his knee gets wrenched, Dean has to half-carry him back to the car, Sam's arm slung over his shoulders and Dean's arm wrapped around Sam's waist. Dean bitches the whole way. He got drenched in the muck monster's guts, and Sam slipped while laughing at him. Dean stops outside the car and insists on them both stripping down to their shorts before he helps Sam into the back seat, and he's bending over with his knee planted on the seat between Sam's legs, easing him backwards, and Sam lets go of Dean's shoulders instead of pulling him down. It's okay. It's going to be okay, because it has to be. They settle down for a month in Pendleton, South Carolina, a small town near the Blue Ridge Mountains. They're laying down a complicated trap for a haunting that comes back every 40 years and kills a whole lot of people. They work on the trap at night in the church graveyard. During the day, Dean works at a local garage and Sam does yard work, so they can pay in cash for food and the cheap apartment they've rented in someone's converted barn, since running a fake credit card that long's too risky. Money's always tight, so they cook instead of eating out. Rice and beans and whatever meat is cheapest at the market that week, with something green on payday and canned fruit by the day before. Moving around each other in the tiny kitchen, getting into dish towel and soap sud fights cleaning up, it's more home-like than anything he can remember. Sam looks at Dean's hand on the table, doesn't cover it with his own, doesn't step behind Dean while he's chopping something up and kiss him on the side of the neck. But he doesn't mind so much that he can't. It still feels like something. 2 weeks in, Dean's running flirtation with the brown-eyed girl who waitresses at the local bar turns into a date, and Sam works in the graveyard alone all that night, long past when they'd usually stay, until dawn turns the sky pink and he has to grab up the tools in a hurry and scoot, before the pastor or anybody else spots him. He goes back to the apartment tired and hungry. Dean still isn't there. He won't be there most nights for the rest of the month until they leave, and it's just a cheap $80 a month place to sack out, with paint peeling off the walls and a sink that drips endlessly. Dean harasses him about girls once in a while, and then in Wyoming they come back to the motel from the bar where Sam said, "Thanks, but I'm seeing someone," and Dean slams the door behind them. "What the hell, man? You're turning into some kind of monk. You could have at least talked to her." It's gone beyond his usual chivying. Dean sounds half bewildered, so Sam tries the next time, in a bar in Montana a week later. He smiles, buys a girl a drink, talks to her a while. Her name's Katie, and she's studying organic agriculture at the university, and she's pretty and sweet, and Sam likes her a lot. But there's no spark at all, and she knows it, too. She gives him her email at the end and says to write her, just friends, and Sam thinks he even might. Dean rolls his eyes when Sam comes back to the table and says, "You couldn't seal the deal? This is what happens when you get out of practice." Except it's not just Katie. Sam tries again with Jennifer, with Gisella, with Renee, really trying by the end, and there is nothing, as though all desire in him has been swallowed up by the one thing he's not allowed to have. He starts to fake it so Dean won't notice. He walks girls out to their cars and finds another bar, or a church when he can, and spends the night sitting in the pews silently. He doesn't pray. He's stopped praying lately. He's already been told no. Instead, he lights candles for company, and visions start coming to him one after another in the flames. Losing himself in the visions helps. He doesn't feel the urge to ask as much anymore, and it helps with the work, too. He recognizes most of the people they meet now, knows their faces and the sound of their voices, knows what they're going to say. He doesn't tell Dean. Instead, he pretends to have found new contacts over the internet, claims to have read things in books that he's only seen in fire, and works the more critical witnesses aside, so Dean doesn't overhear what he says to them, the things he tells them that make their faces go pale, their mouths open and spill out their secrets. One night near the end of summer, the candle lights up before he touches it with the taper. He puts money in the box anyway, and goes back to the motel. Dean is asleep in bed, his shoulders and arms bare above the white sheet. He mumbles briefly as Sam comes in, without waking up. Sam lies down on the other bed, on top of the covers, and stares into the darkness of another year like this. Over the next months, power grows in him like a strangling vine, something mysterious and unstoppable, feeding off the rich dark earth of his rotting secret and the vigils he holds. Loneliness grows with it, creeping into moments that used to be safe, long stretches of road in the car, working in silence together at night, overcast days, until there are only brief moments of light breaking through. Dean prods him awake in the middle of a flat stretch of Colorado and says, "Hey, talk to me, I'm falling asleep here." Sam opens his mouth and for a long, terrifying minute can't speak, has nothing to say, nothing at all. Finally, he blurts out, desperate, because Dean is about to look at him, "You could try listening to something more up-to-date than the greatest hits of 20 years ago. And starts a retread of an argument they've had so often that he can say his lines even though he doesn't feel one way or another about it anymore. One day, the thought slides into his head that maybe he should go it alone. Dean is just holding him back now. Alone, Sam wouldn't have to go through all the motions. He could talk keys out of motel clerks and rides out of truck drivers, unerringly find the graves of vengeful ghosts and burn them into ash with a single hot-eyed look, twist the heads off vampires without even using a blade, if he was alone. In Arizona, Dean finally catches him. "What the fuck are you doing?" he says, his voice rough and scared, bouncing off the walls of the church, every candle in the place burning tall and white like a brand, voices whispering louder and louder in Sam's ears. "What are you?" Then Dean stops talking, just grabs Sam by the arm and drags him out, candles going out behind them like the breath of a god. Back in the motel, Dean shoves him down to sit on the floor, circling around him furious and terrified as he pours salt and flips through their dad's journal and casts one ritual of protection after another. And somewhere around the third, Sam starts getting a feeling like pins and needles, blood creeping back into what had become a phantom limb. When Dean cuts himself in the fifth one, deep, and spills his own blood, Sam jerks and says, "No!" as terror and love and hunger rise up in him, and suddenly there's color in the world again, and pain. Sam bends down over the sharp ache in his gut, gasping, and wonders when's the last time he ate. Dean goes down to his knees on the floor in front of him, gripping Sam's shoulders, and holds him braced through the worst of it, saying things Sam can't hear over the roaring in his ears. As the voices fade away, Sam thinks he hears one low, angry hiss. "It's okay," he tells Dean the next morning. "I'm better." Sitting in the wrecked, bloody room, he tells Dean all the truths he can share about the growing powers, the steady rise of his visions. And then the next morning, in a diner overflowing with hazy sunlight, Sam tells him the one lie, that it's all gone, desire, lust, that he doesn't feel anything like that anymore. When Dean starts to try and press him on it, Sam says, letting himself sound as low and tired and desperate as he feels, "Don't make this harder on me than it already is." Dean shuts up like a box someone's closed the lid on. Sam stops the vigils and starts praying again, slowly remembering the things he's still grateful for, the things he still wants to keep safe and ask for. He finds that he can talk to Dean again, the secrets pruned back to the root coiled deep inside his heart. Sam can look at Dean and love him and fear for him, and more than occasionally want to beat his head in with a stick. But it also hurts again. It's hard again, especially when Dean looks at a girl across the room a few days later, and Sam has to tell him to go. "Don't be an asshole," Sam says. "When you start lighting candles with your brain, then you can be celibate too." "Jesus, don't even joke," Dean says, and finally he gets up and goes. But afterwards, he comes back to the motel room early, and if Sam feels guilty about that, Dean's doing it because he's scared, because he wants to make sure Sam's not out there getting lost inside his head again. At least Sam still hasn't asked. But he still wants to. The desire doesn't go away. Sam gets angry and bursts sometimes, sudden choking rage grabbing him and shaking him like a rag doll. It doesn't seem fair that it's not enough to give up what he wants, that he has to keep giving it up, that not asking is a choice he has to make every day. Sometimes, when he's alone in the motel room, he almost wants that cold, black, freeing isolation again. He wants to just walk out and lose himself in the endless back roads of America, let go of this for good. But then Dean comes back through the door and softly asks, "Sammy?" And there's so much fear in his voice that Sam can't even pretend to be asleep, has to say, "Yeah, I'm here," right away, and he knows he can't go. He can't put Dean through a night where he walks through that door and there's no answer from the dark. But while he's waiting, alone and silent, he can't help but imagine what it would be like, if, what it would mean to be able to curl up around Dean's body, nights when it's so cold their breath frosts inside a cheap, barely heated room, and rub warm color back into his skin. To have Dean's hands on him when he's sick and tired and his head is aching with the future. to be able to brush his fingers over Dean's purpled bruises and make sure his stitches haven't pulled free when he's hurt, to know Dean's mouth with his own, slow and tender, under the taste of beer and potato chips and red licorice candy, just an easy kiss in passing. To say, "Hey, pull over," while they're driving by a big, overgrown field on a yellow, sunny day, and make Dean come out and spar with him until they go tumbling down into crushed grass and kisses. He jerks off to the images sometimes. Sometimes he doesn't. But either way, he can't get to sleep until Dean comes back to the room. Then Sam rolls onto his side, whichever way has him facing away from Dean's bed, and listens to Dean rummage around quietly, taking off his boots, the creak of his mattress. It illuminates clear and bright as fluorescent lights that this is what Sam really has, listening to Dean from across the room, and he doesn't so much fall asleep as drift off the edge of the gray off-color world. They kill a dust devil outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Dean gets picked up by an honest-to-God cowgirl, a rodeo circuit rider who comes up to the bar and steals his shot of whiskey and says, "Sugar, I'm gonna take you back to my place and ride you all night long, if that sounds all right to you." Which Dean's died-and-gone-to-heaven expression says it damn well does. Sam has a grin plastered to his face before Dean can look over. He raises his glass in a toast, and Dean gets hauled away by the belt buckle. As soon as they're out the door, Sam pays the bar tab and leaves. There's a church next to the motel, just a little one-story clapboard job probably supported by men of the road making amends for their visits to the strip club across the street. He stands in the parking lot looking at it, thinking about candles and flames. Sam doesn't think he can stand going into the room to lie there awake all night. Instead, he jimmies the maid closet for a bucket and some sponges, and he washes the Impala under the one street lamp in the parking lot. She's gotten a little dusty and a little dinged up from all the desert back roads they've been driving. What she really needs is some body work, but all Sam can do is give her a couple extra coats of wax. "Dude, what the hell are you doing?" Sam looks up from where he's kneeling down by the front fender, trying to polish away a scratch that won't be going anywhere. Dean is standing next to the car, staring at him. It's about 2 in the morning. I didn't expect you back," Sam blurts, too honestly, and tries to cover for it. "There were some kids in the next room over making a racket. I couldn't sleep." "Right." Dean runs a hand over the rear fin, just resting it there. He's carefully not looking over at the church. "You ready to crash?" "Yeah," Sam says, and puts down the rag. His back crackles as he stands up, and Dean almost puts a hand on his arm, but Sam manages to turn quick enough to avoid it, without looking like that's what he's trying to do. But the next morning, Dean's out and back to the room in 15 minutes flat before Sam even finishes waking up, armed with coffee and donuts and a plan. "Come on, let's get a change of scene. I'm sick of the fucking Southwest. It's getting too hot down here. Come on, I'll let you pick the music." They drive 12-hour days, and Dean demonstrates how truly freaked out he is by keeping his word and letting Sam run the tape player. They stop for lunch in Goodwin, Arkansas, at a place next door to a used record store. Sam says he's going to the bathroom and runs over and buys a bag of random cheap cassettes the guy has collecting dust on the wall. He plays Lionel Richie and Sheena Easton and Pat Benatar for 3 hours until Dean finally yells, "Okay, that's fucking it," and yanks the tape and throws it out the window halfway through Love is a Battlefield. Sam presses the back of his clenched fist to his mouth to stifle the snickers. He lets them out when Dean predictably starts singing the interrupted song under his breath. "Oh, fuck you," Dean says, when he realizes what he's doing, and Sam cracks up completely and laughs until he cries, wiping tears off on his sleeve. And afterwards, his chest loosens up and he breathes deep for the first time in long months. That good, cracked-open feeling lasts until they stop in New York and clear a poltergeist out of a dance club in Chelsea. Dean ends up at the bar afterwards, flirting with three girls at once. Sam slips away to the far end of the bar, trying not to hear, until Dean comes over and says, "Hey." "I'll see you back at the hotel," Sam says, and waits until Dean's gone. Before he can leave, the bartender gets off shift and slides onto the seat next to him with two glasses of whiskey. He's got peroxide blue hair and brown eyes, but he's wearing a thick silver ring on his right hand, and in the dark room his voice sounds a little like Dean's. Sam gets fucked in the trashed back room over the one table left upright, his eyes shut and pretending that he's jerking himself off to hide that his dick isn't hard. He doesn't really want it, but it's something he can have. They've taken a room with one bed because it was impossible to get anything else last minute in the city, and Dean slips under the covers at 2 in the morning, still warm and smelling of sex and sweat, putting one hand on Sam's shoulder to make sure he's there. Sam keeps his back turned and curls himself tight to the edge of the bed, around the hot urgent pressure between his legs, and feels ugly and unclean and sick. A few days later, Ellen sends them to Rhode Island hunting a demon that's possessed a teenage girl. They split up, chasing it through the narrow streets of Providence, and Sam corners it between a churchyard wall and a half-circle of salt. He's already beginning the exorcism. It shrieks furious defiance at him, and then, towards the end, says, "I could give him to you." And Sam's voice chokes off, for just a moment, the shame that's been living in his gut all the way from New York climbing up thick in his throat. "I could give him to you," it repeats, gaining strength, and then quick as a snake knocks the book out of his hands. It leaps for his throat and he grabs it by the wrists to keep it off, full of terrible, desperate fury. With a wordless scream, he pushes, casts out, and suddenly there's a pillar of black smoke rising away into the air. The girl falls limply into his arms, crying, and it's like all his bones have been hollowed out. He feels light as air, swept clean. It's the end of the second year since they left Georgia with a prophecy in their back pocket. Dean comes running up to him from around the corner. Sam gently helps the girl to sit down, and then he straightens up and says to Dean, "It's time." They start hunting the yellow-eyed demon for real, going from one case of demon possession to another. They interrogate the possessed before Sam kicks the demons out of them, and follow a trail of sulfur breadcrumbs and coal-black eyes through the quiet dark towns of New England, then back down south through Connecticut and Jersey, Pennsylvania and Delaware. "All right, that's it," Dean says in Maryland, after the 5th demon in as many weeks and states. "This all-work and no-plaything is getting old." He makes a big show of reluctantly volunteering to be dragged to the Smithsonian, but Dean spends hours in the Air and Space Museum. And when it's Sam's turn to choose, all Sam really wants to do is walk along the mall and stop by the Vietnam Memorial. He puts his fingers on the names carved in black stone and sees flashes of their lives, smiling families, children who grew up without fathers, parents without sons. Dean watches him with worried, narrowed eyes, but Sam's fine for the first time in a long time. He understands now what it's all been for. His power, it's not evil in and of itself, but it demands the fuel of sacrifice and pain. Mom, and Jess, and Dad. That was enough to set him on this road, but not enough to give him the power to see it through to the end, and there was only one other thing left to give. Giving up what they could have had, what he could have asked Dean for. Now he gets it. That's the price of not having to give up Dean himself, not having to open his eyes to see Dean's blood dripping down onto him and watch him consumed in fire, just so Sam can be forged into some kind of avenging sword. It's worth it, a deal he'd gladly have made, and it almost makes him want to cry with relief now that he finally understands. Now that he knows there's going to be an end to all of this. Sam isn't going to walk away from this fight, but that's okay. That's more than okay. Dean is going to walk away, and that's what matters. They pick up help along the way. Joe pulls up next to them in a motel parking lot in West Virginia with Charlie in tow, a young black man from North Carolina with a voice like Cool Silver who can communicate mind to mind with anyone he's ever met, even miles apart. They pick up Lisa, another telekinetic, in Ohio. A demon-possessed cable guy is slowly strangling her with wire when Dean and Joe kick down the door. He looks up with a kitchen knife protruding from his throat, blood drizzling down the sides of his mouth, and Sam touches him on the forehead and sends him to his rest while they unwind the cable from around Lisa's throat. But they win some, they lose some. Sam calls Andy in Oklahoma every day for a week, and there is no answer. Finally, he manages to reach Tracy after hacking a database to get her unlisted number. She doesn't want to talk to him much, but she says, "He went missing a few weeks ago," before she hangs up, and Sam closes his phone up and looks over at Dean, who shakes his head, unsmiling. The mind control power is one of the ones he least wants to see on the other side. In a Kentucky rest stop, they run into Reba, a 40-year-old veteran hunter with two sawed-off shotguns she can handle in one hand apiece, blessed and anointed. They can slam a demon back 10 yards with a single shot of silver. "I'm on the trail of a whole mess of 'em," she says. "They've been coming together. Don't know why, but odds are it's for nothing good." Hunters don't like to come out and ask for help, but when they leave, she's in the caravan with them. Lisa rides along with her, so Sam and Dean have the Impala back to themselves. The hunters become the hunted. They're attacked on the lonely industrial stretch of I-94 that winds through Illinois and Wisconsin by a pack of the demon-possessed on motorcycles with shotguns and swords. Sam shuts his eyes while Dean swerves madly from one side of the highway to the other. One by one, the motorcycle tires burst into hot, sinking flames, and the riders go skidding away to either side, leaving black scorch marks on the road. When they've all been taken down, Dean pulls over and they get out with silver and salt and a super soaker filled with holy water. Joe is already chanting an exorcism over the one nearest her while Reba and Lisa cover her. The leader of the pack is tougher, red-eyed and snarling, and it takes a real fight to cast him out. In the end, Sam lays both hands on his head, and when he finishes speaking the last words of the exorcism and the demon goes pouring out in a thunder of howling smoke, everyone is staring at him. "What?" Sam says, looking at Dean. Dean's the only one who isn't looking back, though. He's watching the others, and his eyes are cold. "Sam," Joe says finally, "you were glowing." There's something strange in her voice, something stranger in the way the others all look at him. Awe, or maybe fear. Except for Dean, who says abruptly, "All right, quit standing around. Let's get the hell out of here before the police show up and start asking questions," and stalks back to the car. Has that ever happened before?" Sam asks him. "No," Dean says, flatly, without taking his hands off the wheel, and drives straight on through Iowa without stopping, until finally Joe's two-seater sports car rips ahead of them with a pointed roar, and Charlie says in their heads, "We're beat, sorry," as she takes the next exit. "Fuck, I hate that," Dean mutters. "Aren't you gonna pull off?" Sam says. Dean glances over at him, irresolute, but in the end he takes the exit too. He gets them a room at the far end of the motel strip and parks the Impala right outside the door. It's 2 a.m. Sam wakes up in the early afternoon and sees Dean sitting up on the bed, cleaning his guns, keeping a watchful eye on the door. "Dean, these are our friends," Sam says. "Yeah, well," Dean says. "Come on, let's get back on the road." Even with a late start, they hit Nebraska by sundown and pull into the roadhouse in time for last call. It's crowded and busy, but they still make an impression coming in. Some of Gordon's crowd are there, and they eye Sam and Charlie and Lisa with sidelong glances, testing knife edges with their thumbs. Lisa smiles at them with a lot of teeth, and floats the glasses over to their table from the bar. If it was quiet before, afterwards it's as silent as a tomb. Ellen and Ash have a map for them of demonic possessions. It looks like just a random pattern of dots scattered through all 48 contiguous states and some across the borders into Canada and Mexico. But then Ash lays down a second version, adjusted for population size. Suddenly the spots in the Dakotas turn bigger, and the clusters in California and Texas and the eastern seaboard shrink. Then he lays down a third with the dots in four different colors, making four overlapping starburst patterns, larger and smaller, with four focal points. Guthrie, Oklahoma, Saginaw, Michigan, Lafayette, Indiana, and one more small town, almost right in the middle of the country. Andy's missing. Max and Scott are dead, Sam says, because no one else will. No one else is even meeting his eyes. And why us four anyway? There are a lot of others. Why did the demon come after us? Nobody answers, and then Dean puts down his glass and says, flatly, I don't give a fuck. He looks at Ash. Can you use this to tell us where the next one's gonna be?
Yeah, more or less, Ash says. I can put you within a 20-mile radius if you give me a couple hours to plot it.
Fine, Dean says. He stands up, raises his voice. All right, everybody here, you all know what's going on. Heads turn to look at him, even the ones that were watching him sideways turning full on. We're heading out first thing tomorrow morning, and we're going to track down every last one of these sons of bitches and send them back to hell for good. Anybody who's with us, we'll see you at dawn. They drive 3 days, through Utah, Nevada, and Oregon, until they're in the mountains of Washington State. It's spring, and the apple trees are all in full bloom. Sam rolls down the window and breathes in the sweet air as they drive down the backcountry roads, smiling at the people they pass, raising a hand.
Okay, man, you're starting to weird me out, Dean says, after the third time. Why the hell are you so happy? We're headed straight into a hurricane here.
We're going to win, Sam says, slouching down into the seat and tilting his head over to smile at him. Dean shaved this morning, and he tossed the leather jacket into the back an hour ago. He's wearing a tight black t-shirt and sunglasses, looking like a movie star, and Sam lets himself enjoy it, drinking in the sight of him like the air, without bitterness, like he hasn't been able to in a long, long time. Dean rolls his eyes. You're a crazy bitch, you know that? Takes one, Sam says, peacefully. They drive a while longer, Dean jockeying to keep in the lead ahead of Joe. She's gotten to be pretty damn good, Sam says when she pulls a fast one and slices in just ahead as the road narrows down to one lane. She's gotten to be a pain in the ass, Dean says, glaring vengefully at her taillights. She might not be bad to work with once in a while. I mean, after this is over, Sam adds. You know, if you felt like it. Dean throws him a narrow look. What the hell's that supposed to mean? Sam shrugs a little, not even trying to hide his smile. Nothing. He looks back out the window at her car, zipping along just at the top range of the Impala's speed, taunting them. And he's just glad, not jealous, not resentful. It's not Yellow Eyes, but it's one of his brood. Sam can tell by the oily psychic stink of its presence, sulphurous and black in the empty room where he and Dean pick up the trail. It's no easy job to nail the sucker down. They spread out across the city and lose two hunters, a pair from Louisiana, as the bastard breaks through their ring and takes off in a stolen car. When they find the bodies, Dean closes their eyes with a bloody hand, but they don't stop for a burial. They chase the demon across the state line into the skinny strip of northern Idaho, heading for the Canadian border, and Sam wakes up in the middle of the night with a vision blazing across his mind. "Bastard doubled back on us!" he yells, and Dean whips the Impala around with tires screaming against the asphalt and blazes back the wrong way along the highway shoulder, ignoring the shrieking horns of the passing trucks, and gets to the end of their caravan just as a big, ugly Dodge SUV smashes sideways into Riordan's pickup truck that's bringing up the rear and takes it careening off the side of the road. Dean pulls over and they're both out in a single movement before the Impala is even completely stopped, grabbing the guns already locked and loaded in the back seat. Riordan's slumped against the steering wheel, blood trickling down from his temple, and the driver of the SUV isn't in sight. Dean jerks his head, signaling silently. Sam nods, and they go opposite ways around the crash. Some of the other hunters are circling back, too. The demon doesn't have a lot of time, and Sam figures it knows as much. Then suddenly it's there, on him, eyes solidly black, hands locked around his throat. Sam hasn't tried the casting out on one of the demon's offspring before, and it's choking him hard, spots dancing in front of his eyes as he tries to keep his throat uncrushed with telekinesis. The black weight of it is on him, heavy and sickening. Then Dean's there, shotgun muzzle up against the thing's head, and he blows holy blessed silver right through its skull from one temple to the other. The demon jerks, and Sam brings up his arms and knocks its hands off to either side, gripping it by the wrists and taking it over onto its back. Dean blows out the demon's kneecaps, too, then slams the shotgun down across its thighs and puts his full weight on them. "Better hurry, Sammy," he says, straining the back of his throat. The demon's bucking under them, too strong to keep hold of, and Sam looks down into the endless black of its eyes and says, "I command you, unclean spirit." It hisses furiously and spits at them, writhing, but he's done this so often now the words keep coming without any effort at all. The power's rising in him like a tide to match the blackness under his hands, and this time he sees it too, light under his skin like someone shining a flashlight through a sheet. The demon's face twists and squints away from him. "Let me go," the demon says, lifting its head up from the ground, and then, "Let me go or I'll tell him," while Sam is saying, "Depart, seducer, full of lies and cunning." And for a second Sam's voice stutters. Dean looks up, the demon grins wide and full of teeth, and Sam says, in a voice that belongs to somebody else, just one word, "Out." The demon's eyes widen. There is no pillar of smoke. The black just drains right out of the eyes like a sink emptying. And Sam's looking at a young man with hazel irises and brown skin, blood already pooling in his eye sockets. He breathes out once, and Sam lays him back gently to the ground, the light dying out slowly under Sam's own skin. He looks up. There's a half circle of hunters standing around them, and their faces have that weird twisted look on them, unwilling awe. Sam looks around helplessly at Dean, who's sitting back on his heels. Dean meets his eyes and stands up. "Okay, people, we need to get back on the road." "Hey," Joe says, shoving through the circle. "Looky what I found in Mr. Demon's mommy car." And she holds up a big silver goblet, carved inside and out. Back in the car and back on the road, getting away from the car crash and the two dead bodies, Dean says, without looking over, "What was it going to tell me?" Sam swallows, shrugs a little. "I don't know. It's a demon. They lie." Dean doesn't push it, doesn't say another word, until they're in the motel, salt across the doors and windowsill, curtains pulled tight, weapons cleaned and reloaded. Then he sits down opposite Sam, facing him across the narrow strip between the beds, and says quietly, "You know this slick bastard we're up against. You know what he's capable of, what he's done to us, to our family." Sam drops his eyes to his hands, the good old Colt 45 lying there. Trust Dean to haul out the heavy hitters for this. "Dean, don't." "You want to tell me," Dean goes on, mercilessly, "that you're just gonna give him this? Because you know damn well, Sammy, that yellow-eyed bitch is going to save it for the right moment. He's going to wait until we've got him pinned down, and then he's going to let me have it, whatever it is you're keeping from me, right between the eyes." Sam closes his eyes and lets his head fall forward, because Dean might be right, and he even knows exactly how to tell Dean. He's had almost 3 goddamn years to work out the details. But he doesn't know how to tell Dean without asking, without letting on the way he wants, bone deep and endless, what Dean would die trying to give him. "I can't," Sam says quietly, and Dean stands up and turns away from him, hands braced on his hips. They turn off the lights. He lies on his back and tries to sleep, but Dean's not breathing regularly, and Sam knows he's awake, too. He wants to get up in the dark and crawl into Dean's bed and curl around him without saying a word. Let his hands and his mouth tell Dean the truth. Take just one night with him to remember. He closes his eyes and makes himself remember Jess instead. The soft, wet plucking of her blood dripping onto his face, fire blooming around her in a cloud. Her voice saying, "Sam," as she died. It's probably pretty sick that it's the only thing that lets him get to sleep. They take the cup back to the roadhouse and hunt through all the references and online sources they can find. They try one ritual after another, the cup carefully standing in a devil's trap, but none of it does any good, and they're not going to try the last one, the one that calls for the life's blood of a mortal man. "Told you, waste of time," Gordon says, watching across the room with unfriendly eyes. He didn't come north with them. Then Charlie says, softly, "Let me have it," and when it's in his hands, his eyes go milky white, the way they do when he's speaking mind to mind. Then he gives one scared, sharp gasp, and a swirl of inky black starts to rise in his eyes. Sam lunges across the room to cover his hands where they're clasped around the bowl, pushing back. The strength on the other side is nothing like he's ever felt before, and there's a low, amused laugh echoing inside his skull, hollow and nasty and familiar, and it asks, "You really think you can stop me?" "Where are you?" Charlie's voice says, brave and terrified. "Tell us where you are." The demon speaks to Sam, though, instead. "Why don't you and that brother of yours come on home, Sammy? See what I've done with the place. You're more than welcome. But, I think I'm going to have to get an unlisted number." Charlie screams, inside, and the noise reverberates in Sam's head like thunder, knocking them both to the ground, hands pressing against their temples. Dean's there, grabbing him by the shoulders and bracing him up, and by the time Sam can pick up his head, Jo is holding Charlie's head in her lap. There's blood trickling from his nose and his ears, and he's coughing weakly. The cup is rolling loose on the ground in a rattling circle, cracked, black smoke curling up from the bowl. Dean's still holding him by the shoulders. "I'm goddamn fucking useless," Dean says. "Should never have let him..." "We got it," Sam interrupts, his voice rough. "Charlie got it out of him. We know where he is." They cross the state line the next morning, all of them locked and loaded, the Impala up front leading the charge. "Stop," Sam says abruptly, one exit before Lawrence. "Get off here." Dean pulls off and turns into the parking lot of the first motel, puts the Impala in park. The lot is empty otherwise, and though the vacancy sign is lit, there's no sign of a manager or anybody else in the office. Sam stands in the lot, facing the direction of Lawrence. He can feel the pressure of it on his face, a storm in the distance, about to break. "Tomorrow," he tells Dean. It's not completely true. They don't have to wait. This train's being held in the station for them, and it'll go whenever they get on board. But Dean looks tired, and Sam wants one last night. It won't change anything. Dean doesn't ask if he's sure, and neither does anybody else. "Okay," Dean says to the other hunters. "Everybody gets 8 hours of sleep. We'll take shifts keeping watch. Let's go." It gets dark early, even though it's summer. Dean carries all the weapons into their room and starts cleaning them, loading. Sam lies down on the other bed and shuts his eyes and lets the familiar comforting noise sink into his bones. He won't be using weapons tomorrow. He is going to be one. "I need you to tell me something," Dean says, without turning around. When Sam opens his eyes, Dean's back is hard and rigid, his hand with the Glock resting against his thigh. "I need to know you're planning on coming back from this thing." Sam pushes himself up to sitting and takes the easy way out. "With what we're up against..." "Yeah, it's a crapshoot. That's not what I'm talking about, and you know it," Dean says. He doesn't turn around. "You've been doing a lot of that looking out of the window, smelling the roses, saying goodbye to the world thing, man. And I need to know you're not looking for a blaze of glory to go out on." Sam doesn't say anything. He can't. The silence stretches. Dean breathes out.
Right, he says, low. In that case, so you understand, if you don't make it, I don't either.
Sam tries to say something, can't manage anything more than, that's not...
Don't even, Dean says, his head bent over his gun. Don't you fucking say another word to me.
Sam gets up off his bed and goes to sit down next to him. Dean doesn't look up, still working on the Glock with steady hands. After a minute, he says, softly,
I wouldn't even want to, Sammy.
Because you're a stupid jerk, Sam says, fear making his voice a rough snarl. Just because, if something happens...
You're the one who ever wanted some other kind of life outside of this, Dean says. Not me.
You're the one who wanted this life, Sam says. Protecting innocent people, the helpless. You think just because we take out this one demon there won't be more?
Dean shrugs. Somebody else's turn.
Sam stands up and walks as far away as he can get, which is about 3 steps in the tiny room. Dean.
Sam, I get it, man. You're scared, Dean says. And I don't blame you. All this crazy shit that's been happening to you, maybe it looks like this is all part of some big heroic destiny thing where you take that yellow-eyed son of a bitch down with you and leave me behind to tell the tale. But I'm telling you right now, fuck that noise.
He stands up, and Sam can feel it without even turning around. He can see the look in Dean's face with his eyes shut, that smile he wears when he's telling the whole world to go to hell.
One way or another, you want to ride out all the way to Valhalla? I'll go there with you. But you're not getting away without me, even if I have to eat my own gun to catch up.
Sam whirls around and grabs him, shoves him hard up against the wall.
Don't you fucking even say that.
Dean's not yielding an inch, eyes cold and steady as the grave.
That's how it is, he says. You don't like it? You better start working off a game plan that doesn't involve you taking a bullet for me or anybody else.
He smiles then, and it's something broken and askew.
I'm not getting left behind again, Sam. I'm not.
Sam just stands there, his hands clenched into Dean's shirt and his mouth trembling. The room's making rattling noises, lamps and furniture and the scattering of keys and loose change stirring uneasily. All his powers useless to protect Dean against his own stupid fucking determination, and he should have seen this coming, because Dean's never forgiven Dad, and he's never believed he should be alive. Don't, Sam whispers. His eyes are stinging. They've been dry, and he hasn't been sleeping a lot. He's been ready for it to be over. He's ready to lay this down. These last few weeks, seeing the end of the road up ahead, being able to just feel this love without jealousy or resentment, it's been like getting out of a cage. What is there to step back inside for? Power he doesn't want, and a fight he's done with, feeling like he's strangling Dean's life the days he's not choking to death himself?
We don't have to keep doing this, Dean says, his hands coming up to cover Sam's, wrapping over his fists.
Sammy, after this is over, we'll go somewhere, I don't know, Mexico or something, get ordinary jobs, build a house. You can read 5 fucking books a day and sleep 12 hours, man, anything you want. Just...
He's desperate, laying everything on the table, anything he can think of. It would be so easy. All Sam needs to do is let his hands slide up from Dean's chest to cup his face, lean in, just a little, and Dean will know everything. And he won't even hesitate. He'll put his hands on Sam's waist and pull him close, kiss him deep and take him to the bed fast as he fucking can, just to seal the deal, guess and fumble his way through the whole thing. And Dean will be grateful for the trade, no matter what it does to him. A high place, with all the kingdoms of the world laid out for him, and Sam lets himself have this much. For one moment he leans close and puts his arms around Dean and just holds him,
buries his head against Dean's neck to shut out the light. Dean grabs back onto him just as fiercely, and Sam spends the night in Dean's bed after all, chastely, his head pillowed on Dean's shoulder and Dean's arms wrapped tight around him, and he shuts his eyes while the cage door closes back on him. They cross into Lawrence the next morning. When they cross the line, Sam gets a weird feeling like his ears are popping, and afterwards the sense of pressure is gone. Everything looks normal as they head through the streets. There are people walking on the sidewalk, mowing the lawns, kids playing, but there's something wrong about all of it. He's gripping the door, instinctively, and his other hand's braced on the dashboard. "What the fuck?" Dean says. "The town outside was empty. Why is everything okay here?" "It's not," Sam says, shaking, and when they roll up to a traffic light, the driver in the Camry next to them looks over with solid black eyes. "Jesus," Dean says, groping for the bottle of holy water, but the light changes, the driver turns his head forward again, and the car pulls away. Sam looks out the window on his side. There are a couple of kids drawing on the sidewalk with chalk. They're drawing Satanist runes and sigils in pink and cornflower blue and sunny yellow, and their eyes are black and empty when they look up at him. A woman is sitting on the bench behind them like she's watching over them, a kind of sick mockery, her eyes big glossy jet beads. Dean's staring over his shoulder. "Why aren't they doing anything? Why aren't they trying to stop us?" "Nobody's going to stop us," Sam says. "Not unless we try to turn back." "Keep going. Dean, please, keep going." It's stupid, because it's only going to get worse from here, but Sam isn't sure how it could. He can't bear to look at those hollowed-out puppets. Dean puts the Impala back in gear and rolls off slow, like someone walking carefully away from a sleepy predator. The street widens, and Dean kicks the speed up some, taking them past the other cars on the road as fast as he can. "Take the next left," Sam says abruptly, almost not in time, and the Impala squeals some as Dean catches the turn. They're looking down a long straight road, lying under that strange thunderstorm kind of light, where the trees are sunlit in the foreground and the gray sky is full of black clouds with brilliant glowing edges. In the distance, at the end of the road, there's a tall metal gate standing. They drive towards it for what feels like a long time without getting closer, and Sam doesn't think it's an optical illusion. There are no people along the street anymore, only empty houses with their windows like gaping eye sockets, and the trees flashing past them look strange, tall and black and leafless, twisting in a wind they don't feel. He wonders if maybe there's something they didn't do, some protection they needed, and now they'll be trapped here on this road endlessly, driving forever. He looks over at Dean, his profile etched against the winter gray sky outside the window. "This is getting ridiculous," Dean says, his mouth set and grim. He pats the dashboard. "Come on, baby, get us there," and puts both hands on the wheel and slams the gas down. The Impala roars. Dean's tended her with his own hands since he got the keys on his 18th birthday. Dad used to joke that it was even odds he was conceived in the back seat. Sam's drawn sigils and runes on her skin 100 times, made circles around her with salt and holy water, said silent prayers, and cast spells out loud. Dean rebuilt her from a demon-crushed wreck stained with Winchester blood. They've slept and eaten and fucked in her seats. She's carried guns and spirits and demons and taken them through every state in the Continental Union, and she's always given Dean everything he's asked for. Her whole frame shudders now like she's putting her head down to push 100 miles per hour up a steep incline, though the road is level all the way out before them, and suddenly the sky starts getting darker overhead. It's the solid black of night without moon or stars when they abruptly get to the end of the road, dirt and gravel spraying when Dean has to slam on the brakes. 3 cars out of 11 make it through with them. Joe and Charlie in her Mustang, the old rosary Ellen gave her hanging from the rearview mirror. Reba's 4-wheel-drive Subaru station wagon with runes etched into the bumpers all around, and Lisa gasping and sweating against the dashboard from pushing.
Gordon's Firebird, pentacles smoking on the hood and the trunk, where he'd put them on with his own blood under the last coat of paint. There's no sign of the others on the road behind them. There's no town behind them at all. But where? Lisa says, shakily. What happened to... She stops. It's not a question any of them really want an answer to, not when there's nothing they can do about it. They turn to face forward instead, seven together at the gates that say Stall Cemetery. They shouldn't be able to see anything. The sky is pitch black empty, and there's no source of light. But everything around them is clear as a photograph, visible without illumination. A path of pale stones leads up to an old white-painted church standing on the hill.
"Looks like we're the only ones made it to the party," Dean says, calmly as if he's walked into hell 100 times before. "Let's load up, people. Silver bullets and rock salt shells."
He turns to pop the Impala's trunk. Sam watches him load up, small silver knives on both ankles, the silver-plated machete over one shoulder, shotgun slung over the other. Glock to hold, the Heckler and Coke shoved in his waistband for spare, and his pockets loaded up with ammo. Dean takes out his whiskey flask, and they each take a long swallow, burning all the way down, and then Dean pours the rest of it out on the ground and fills it with holy water instead. Then Sam spots something poking out from under the pile of loose knives. He leans in and digs out his old claw knife, holds it across his palms. "To Sammy, from Dad," engraved along the arc of the blade.
"Wish he was here," Dean says, pouring salt into a canister. "He's not looking over."
Sam knows Dean would undo Dad's deal in a heartbeat if he could. He's never told Dean before how he feels about it, because he wasn't sure it wouldn't hurt Dean worse to hear. It hurts Sam to say it out loud, to mean it, when he says softly, "I'm glad you are." Dean flinches too, just stands there for a moment, staring into the trunk, his hands stilled. Then he swallows, his throat working, and he says roughly, "You ready?" "Yeah," Sam says, and they slam the trunk shut. Dean rests his hand on the lid for a moment, and then they're turning to form up with the others. Dean puts Gordon up front with him, and Reba with Joe bringing up the rear, Sam and Lisa and Charlie protected in the middle.
"You figure they're gonna come at us as soon as we go in?" Gordon says, his thumb rubbing over the guard of his Sig Sauer. "I figure we plan on it, and we won't get surprised," Dean says,
and they rush the gate and stop just inside, crouched and waiting. Nothing happens, which is kind of an anticlimax. Lisa giggles once, nervously. She stops right away. Laughter is not a sound that lives here, and the echoes come back to them with sharp, mocking edges.
"Okay," Dean says, "up to the church."
They walk up the path slowly, tense, but nothing approaches them. Nothing seems to be moving. As they get closer, Sam notices there's a tree standing next to the church, a big old oak with heavy, massive branches spread out to either side, 10 feet off the ground. Out of the corner of his eye, he keeps catching glimpses of things hanging from the branches, long black shapes swaying from nooses in the non-existent wind. When he looks at it directly, it's bare.
"Showtime," Dean says, sharp and fast, and Sam jerks his head back.
"Hey, guys," Andy says, standing in the doorway of the church, smiling and relaxed. "How about you all just hang out right here? And why don't you put down those guns?" They had talked about this play, how they'd run it. Charlie would fuzz everyone's head with telepathic noise. Sam would keep them from being used against each other. Lisa would try and neutralize Andy. But the last time he saw Andy, Sam didn't even notice his commands. The pressure of his power was like nothing more than a faint breeze on Sam's face. But now it's like running headlong into a brick wall. Sam's stopped in his tracks as much as the rest of them, halted, and the guns are rattling on the pebbles of the walkway. Andy comes down the stairs of the church to look them over. "Andy," Sam says, thickly. Even moving enough to turn his head to look at him is an effort. "Listen to me. Whatever he said to you, you don't want to do this."
You didn't listen long enough, Sam, so you don't understand, Andy says, gently. That's okay, though. He's a pretty patient guy. You'll have a chance to come around. All of you will, he adds. You and Charlie and Lisa, you guys are going to come with me and see him, okay? Yeah, sure, Charlie says, swallowing, and Lisa's head moves in a jerky nod. Sam's head bobs along even though he tries to stop it. He takes a step forward. No, Dean says, helpless but protesting, and Sam grabs onto it with everything he's got, listens to Dean's voice instead of the rolling echoes of Andy's inside his head. He stops and catches Lisa by the arm and says to Charlie, Don't listen to him. Listen to me. Don't go. Hey, you know, Dean, I was just going to leave the rest of you to play mop-up crew, but if you want to do this the hard way, Andy says condescendingly. He turns toward the graveyard and beckons. There's a sound like a train rattling over a crossing, and pale silverfish gray hands come clawing up through the sod. It's not like bad zombie movies where the dirt explodes out of the way and rotting corpses rise. It's something worse, something wrong, the way the earth just stirs and shuffles and lets them emerge, translucent, wasted things that maybe used to be human and now are just emptiness, hungry eyes and hollow mouths, shadows inside them like parodies of human organs, thin veins of blue tracing over their skin, pulsing. They don't have claws, just ragged, dirty fingernails and mouths full of broken, jagged teeth stained with dried blood. They creep closer, closer, until one of the dead things touches Joe's arm. She makes a small noise, choked off, but she still can't move, even though it's lifting her arm to its mouth like a drumstick. Another one is pawing at Dean's jacket, dragging one sleeve down and exposing his shoulder and the joint of his neck, bare and vulnerable under his thin t-shirt, and he's just standing there. He's just going to stand there. And Sam quits fighting on two fronts, lets go of Lisa and Charlie, and yells, Dean! Lisa and Charlie are already moving again, backing towards the steps, Andy's last command taking hold all over again, and Sam's only a little behind them, stumbling as his feet carry him against his will. But Dean's loose, slamming an elbow back into the rib cage of the revenant, and then he's got the Glock off the ground and aimed dead center between Andy's eyes. Too late. Even as he's moving, Andy says, Why don't you put that in your mouth instead? Sam's, No! Comes just as fast, but it hits Dean like a cross-check, and he's shuddering all over with pain, the pistol sliding loose out of his fingers. Andy laughs. It's not a nice sound. Good job, Sammy. Looks like you're going to fry his brain before he gets around to... And then he's looking down, confused, at the knife hilt sticking out of his chest. Charlie's looking at Reba, hard, his eyes milky. Her guns are all down on the ground in a neat row, and her feet haven't moved from where Andy stopped her, but her jacket's open and she's got a strap full of throwing knives under it. The next one takes Andy in the throat, and he sinks to his knees, mouth opening soundlessly, looking confused, and falls over. Oh, fuck, Dean says, gasping with relief, and sinks forward onto all fours, his head sagging down. Gordon grabs his Sig Sauer up from the ground and pumps three rounds point-blank into the head of the thing that's tearing at Joe's arm, pulping its head into a splatter. Her teeth are clenched, and though tears are sliding down her face, she just nods once when he says, You okay? And bends to grab her semi-automatic back up from the ground. The revenants are still coming, faster now. Lisa starts bodily knocking down the front line and Sam torches them, making a firewall out of their burning bodies. Joe's mowing the others down in swaths through the fire, her slim frame shaking with the recoil but planted and steady, one leg braced back and her knees bent slightly. They keep coming and coming, though, more of them limping and creeping over the hills of the graveyard that just go on into the distance, the weight of the numbers starting to press them back. We can't do this forever, Gordon yells, over the double-barreled fire of his guns. What, you're not having fun? Dean says, holstering the Glock. Cover me.
He pulls out the salt canister and makes a run to lay down a line just inside the firewall, a semicircle around the stairs, Gordon blasting any of the ones who reach through the flames. They all pull back inside the limits and stop, watching, breathing hard. Sam's head is aching and hot, and there are spots in front of his eyes like he's looked into the sun by accident. The revenants stop at the edge of the salt line and stand there with mouths gaping and swaying a little back and forth, blocking the path with their bodies like a wall. There are more of them in back, a solid mass that makes Sam's stomach churn to look at, and the salt is holding them back, but there's nowhere to go but inside.
"Nobody forgot anything in the car, right?" Dean says.
The church is full of neat wooden pews and rows, banks of votives burning in clear glass, and a plain altar on a low stage at the front, underneath a simple wooden cross on the wall. It's empty, but as soon as Sam steps over the threshold, he's struggling to breathe against the thick, smothering pressure, voices rising like a tide in his head, and the candles jump high, laughing. Dean grabs his arm. Behind him, Charlie and Lisa are both twisted up with nausea, hanging back. "Protection," Sam gasps. "Get those pews out of the way," Reba says, slinging down her backpack and pulling out a couple of sheaves of protective symbols. Gordon and Dean are already shoving back the front rows of the pews, and Joe's got her own salt canister out to draw the pentacle with. Dean has to practically carry Sam into it. The pressure recedes a little, enough so Sam can get his feet back under him. They all huddle inside the heart of the star symbol. The same unnatural glow is working here. The candles aren't actually shedding any light at all, just glitter. "Now what?" Lisa says. "Do we just wait here for somebody to show up?" "They're here," Charlie says, and suddenly Sam sees them. Demons like caricatures of wolves, twisted, hunched shadow things made of smoke, white and gray and black, with their edges sharp as knives, crouching behind the tipped-over pews, mouths open and slavering. There are more of them on the steps up to the altar, and there's a woman perched coyly up there, her legs crossed at the ankles and swinging. "Ava," Sam says, and then she smiles, a black-eyed girl, and Dean says, cold and hard as 6 feet of ice, "Meg." "Hey, boys," she says. "Sweet of you to come by and see me like this. And you brought your friends." The pack of demons is drawing close around them, shoving at each other, fanged mouths all grinning, and Sam looks down to see the salt of the pentacle whispering away, a few grains at a time, across the floor. He can still feel the voices, the demons all around him, and he shuts his eyes and breathes deep, pushing out, until he hears them start to snarl and whimper, and when he opens his eyes there's a deep pearlescent glow under his skin, warm, and Gordon shakes his head like someone waking up and says hoarsely, "What the fuck are we waiting for? Let's waste those sons of bitches," and blasts one of the demons with rock salt and consecrated iron. It's one long blur after that. The guns are roaring like a burning house, spent shotgun shells rattling on the floor like bones. Charlie's got one of Joe's backup pieces and is shooting grimly, steadily, while Lisa uses the telekinesis to drag wooden pews around the pentacle like barricades. The demons are torn into smoke, melted, and come wheeling back again, over and over. Meg laughs, bright and cheerful as a knife sharpened up on a whetstone. It's nothing like the laugh Sam remembers, Ava's delighted glee in that motel room, and then suddenly he slips his hand into the pocket of his jacket, down to the little hole into the lining, and his fingers find it buried in the corner down by the end of his zipper, the cool hard band of her engagement ring, still a little flecked with her fiancé's dried blood. He's got nothing to go on but an instinct, but he's sure of this. They haven't got a lot of time left. The salt lines keep creeping away. So he steps out of the pentacle, the ring warming up in his fist, and the light glowing around him. The clawing thick taste of black demon smoke and gunpowder is all around him. "Sam!" Dean's yelling, behind him, but Sam thinks maybe this is the only chance they've got, and he takes another step towards the altar,
fighting for every inch. The demons are all milling around, trying to decide if they're going to take their shot, nervous and wincing away from the glow spilling out of his skin. Sam gets almost to the base of the stairs before one of them finally dashes in, snarling, and Sam falls to his hands and knees, splinters from the wooden floor digging into his palms. His legs burning. He's been hamstrung. The demon's howling and clawing at itself, mouth smoking where Sam's blood is on its lips and teeth, and the others have backed off. But they'll work themselves up again in a minute and come after him. Sam drags himself back up onto one leg, hopping stupidly, and Ava, Meg, laughs at him. "Cute as a one-legged bunny," she says. Ava's sweet, honey voice, Meg's hard edge, and she jumps down off the altar and comes to stand at the top of the stairs, leaning down. "Think you can beat 'em up here, Sammy? Because I think I'm going to stand here and watch them gut you on the stairs while you're trying to crawl." And maybe she's right, but he's still got to try. And then a shotgun blast takes out two of the wolf demons as they're coming at his back. Dean's there, and Gordon, and Reba, and Lisa, pushing out with their hands against the demon horde. They've come out of the ring to give him the chance with their own lives, and the demons are all howling in delight and leaping on them, savage. Sam doesn't look for more than a second, just long enough to see Dean get one with a machete, to see Gordon shoot one that's about to drag Lisa down, to see another one claw Reba open from shoulders to hips, and then he jerks his head around and lunges up the stairs. Meg's face twists with anger, but Sam's got her by the wrist, saying, "Ava, Ava, I know you're in there. Come on, help me." Meg grins and kicks his leg out, dumping him to his knees with a groan that he can't swallow. She grabs him by the hair and the throat and slams him into the altar, ribs cracking like matchsticks as his skin hisses smoke, even though he's pushing back with the telekinesis, with all his own strength. It hurts where she's holding on to him. They're both burning, but she's holding on, pinning him down and pressing. Sam chokes for breath, struggling too hard to pull anything together but words, still trying to reach Ava and gasping, "Ava, it's Sam, it's me, listen to me, we can fight her, together, just..." But he's not sure he believes it, and with the shadow creeping in around his eyes, it's making her face look more like the demon wolves than Ava's, all hard, cruel lines. Then there's a kick like a horse. She coughs, and her hands loosen. She tilts her head down. There's a gaping hole in her chest, smoking where iron fillings and salt cling to the edges. Dean lunges forward and wraps his arms around her neck and hauls back, dragging her off Sam. "Okay," she says, weird and slurred. Sam can see the edge of a crumpling lung moving inside her ribcage. "Now I'm getting a little annoyed." She grabs Dean's arm and pushes it the wrong way back, the elbow cracking. Dean grunts out a short, tight breath, and it brings Sam back out of the fog clinging to his brain, in time to scream, "Dean!" as Meg turns around and smashes a backhand fist across his face and spills him down the stairs. Sam heaves himself off the altar, sliding to his knees. She turns around, smiling, Dean's blood and Ava's on her face, but he's on the right level and he grabs her wrist and slides the ring back onto her finger and closes her fist around it. "Ava," he says, looking up at her, and the black eyes flicker even when Meg grabs his throat again with her other hand. "Ava," Sam says again. There are tears sliding out of the corners of her eyes, and he closes his own eyes, grabs onto her wrists. Ava's helping him now, pushing from inside. Together they force the demon out in a roar of black smoke that goes on, until at last Ava tumbles down limp to the floor. Sam crumples with her. Her head lolls back and she smiles at him, just for a moment. Then the light goes out in her eyes, and there's a feeling like a silent thunderclap in the room, a shockwave that strains the cracked ribs inside Sam's chest. And she's gone. He can't move. It's all he can do to keep breathing. Ava's dead body is huddled up against the altar, and everything's quiet,
No guns, no snarling demons. The pressure's gone and the voices are silent. It feels cool and damped down inside his head. He's got nothing left. Footsteps sound on the wooden floor, coming up the stairs. Dean, Sam says, whispering. His throat's too raw for more. The footsteps come closer and stop. Afraid not, the yellow-eyed demon says, and crouches down next to him. He takes Sam by the chin and turns his head so he can see the floor of the church, and Dean lying ragdoll limp at the foot of the stairs, blood in a puddle around his body. No, Sam says. No! Them's the breaks, the demon says. He turns Sam's face up again. Did you really think you were going to beat me on my own turf, Sammy? Thought you had enough juice for that? He smiles. Well, you know what they say about pride. Sam doesn't say anything. Tears are leaking out of the corners of his eyes, forced out one after another by the breaths he has to suck in hard one at a time against his scraping ribcage, stabs of hot pain all up and down his side with every one. He doesn't mind. Pain's good. Pain means this is almost over. The demon laughs. Nonsense. This is hell. Pain is part of the condition, and it can go on a very, very long time. He strokes the back of one knuckle down Sam's cheek. Unless, of course, we can come to an arrangement. There's a bluff to be made here, a final gambit that Dean would have gone for, but Sam's got nothing left to try with. No, he says. I can keep you here anyway, Sam, the demon says. No, Sam says, and shuts his eyes. He's not going to believe that, not if this lasts 1,000 years. He can believe that they've lost, that their best wasn't good enough, and that whatever plague ate River Grove is going to boil out of Lawrence, out of this cemetery, like a swarm of devouring locusts. He can believe that millions will die and more will suffer, that demons will walk the earth in countless hordes. But not that he can be kept alone in hell for trying. The world's not fair. It hurts. It's cruel. An effort doesn't count. But even so, there's too much grace in it for that to be true. He shuts his eyes and thinks, Dean. Shame about him, really, the demon says, ruminatively. But then I suppose that's how he was always going to go out. Pointlessly. Shut up. Sam says. Don't you dare talk about him. And you never even got to bang him, the demon says. That's what you wanted, isn't it? To push your big brother down on his face and put it to him. Maybe see that pretty mouth of his stretched around your cock. He makes a tisk-tisk sound. What would Daddy say? Then he leans forward and says softly, You want to find out, Sam? Should I pull John on up here? Let you have a little confessional moment about the lust in your heart? It's not him, Sam says, willing himself to believe it. You don't have him. Oh, but I do, the demon says. Looks like I've bagged the full set of Winchesters, in fact. Then why are you even talking to me? Sam says. Why don't you just stick us up on your trophy wall and move on? The demon makes a rueful, smiling shrug. You got me. Well, it's just not as good unless you hand yourself over. He sways close and turns his head to pass his nostrils over Sam's mouth, inhaling his breath like someone sniffing a glass of wine. I don't get the real savor of the thing. And you, oh, you, Sammy, you're too delicious. All that noble sacrifice and all that hot, nasty, boiling lust right underneath. Just the kind of soul I really want to sink my teeth into, if you get my drift. Sam shudders away from him, or tries to. The cold marble floor doesn't give. Tell me, Sam, why didn't you ever ask? The demon inquires, his thumb tapping at Sam's lower lip. Did you think Dean would say no? Too busy fucking every truck stop slut to have time for his little brother? He waits, but Sam doesn't answer. Oh well, Dean's not gonna be fucking anyone ever again. He winks. Maybe that's how you wanted it. Go to hell, Sam whispers. It's starting to be real.
He doesn't want to look. He doesn't want to. But his head turns anyway. Dean's so pale. The blood under his cheek is brilliant red over the white stones, and his skin looks like chalk next to it. His lips are purple-blue, and his hands lying half-curled over the Glock. He is still beautiful, the soft curve of his cheek under the day's growth of stubble, the bow of his mouth. Still everything Sam wants in the world. I love you, Sam thinks, silently, because he won't give that to the air in this place. He doesn't remember the last time he said it out loud, not since he was a kid, young enough to say it without worrying about pride or burdens. He's said other things instead, easier things, or things that seemed easier at the time. I'd die for you. I'd do anything for you. Anything, Sam? The demon says softly. Anything at all? Yes, Sam says, never looking away from Dean's face. Well, how about it, Sam? The demon says. I can wake him up easier, snap my fingers. Just say the word. He waits a moment and prods. I'll even toss in a few sweeteners. Dean and Daddy and all the good little boy and girl hunters can go on home, all for one low price. He drops to a stage whisper. And don't let this one get out, but I'll even let you have a last hurrah, one last night on earth to say a real goodbye, take a little taste of Dean to remember him by. Trust me, Sammy, he'll say yes. The demon smiles toothily. What do you say? Sam looks him in his sulfur-yellow eyes and laughs, brokenly, because Dean's never going to know. He's never going to know that he saved Sam after all, last night, when he took that option away. It hurts, and Sam still laughs and warms himself at the demon's narrowing eyes. He laughs until he's tasting blood, and this is what love is, he thinks. Love is lying here with Dean's body cooling on the floor, iron wet and bitter on his own lips, and turning down everything he wants to keep something that's no use to him, only because Dean wanted him to. Giving Dean this one last thing, the last piece of himself he could have called his own, body and heart and life already handed over. I will. I'll do anything for him, Sam says. I'll even keep my promise. And my answer to you is no. The demon is silent. The only sound Sam hears is his own breath, the scrape-scrape of his broken ribs and the blood thickening in his throat. The edges of his sight are darkening, and he thinks, thank you, even though he's saying it to someone who let Dean die, because it means there really is mercy after all. He's going to believe, he's going to trust, that even if he'll never see Dean again, Dean's somewhere beyond pain, and so is Dad, and so are Joe, and Charlie, and Lisa, and Reba, Gordon, and Andy, and Ava. So are Jess, and Mom, and all the people the demons killed and hurt and taken. He'd like to look at Dean one last time, but it hurts too much to move his head. Instead, he just turns his eyes to the church windows, even though there's nothing outside but black. It's better to look at than the demon, anyway. The strange sourceless light is fading away fast, and it's almost completely dark. The roof overhead is vanishing. Sam shuts his eyes and waits, breathing slow and shallow and patient, and when nothing happens, he opens them again. It's not quite dark. He can just make out the window frames, white bars stark against the sky that's turning pearl gray with morning. Sam stares, then looks over sharp. The demon's not there anymore. There's someone else instead. Sam is looking up at the sky, confused. He's not sure what just happened, but the roof of the church is gone. Most of the church is gone, actually. He's lying inside the blackened shell of a building that maybe was a church once, a long time ago, a handful of cracked and glazed panes of glass left standing in window frames. There's a crumpled yellow potato chip bag next to his head, and he's watching the last bright stars fade into morning, and the sun is coming up. His side still aches some, but his ribs aren't grating against each other anymore.
The blood on his mouth has dried. He pushes himself slowly up on his elbows and looks. The pews are gone, and the altar, and the pentagram's just a faint, smoky, broken outline on the floor. There's no blood left, only Dean's body lying there. "Dean," Sam says, and crawls down to him from the altar, past beer cans and broken glass bottles, empty candy wrappers and brown paper bags, cigarette stubs and scraps of plastic, relics of kids playing in a graveyard. Sam's knees sting and his side throbs by the time he gets there. He drags Dean into his lap and curls over his body. "Dean," he says again, and it's a sob. He feels so horribly stupid. He never told Dean that it would work both ways. He never told Dean he wouldn't go on either. He wonders what the idea is now, if he's supposed to get up off the ground and walk out of here and go on with his life, find himself a job and a house and a picture-perfect family, a boy named Dean and a girl named Jess, and maybe another two named John and Mary for good measure. The idea's a faded photograph, scratched up and dog-eared, and Sam doesn't think he can recognize his own face inside it anymore. The only other thing he can think of is to pick up Dean's gun and get in Dean's car and go back on the road, just keep going until he drops in his traces. But Dean said it. Somebody else's turn. And shouldn't that go for Sam, too? Nobody could ask him to do this. Dean wouldn't ask him to do this, to go on alone. Dean wouldn't, but he'd want it, Sam realizes. Dean would want him to live. Sam shuts his eyes against the knowledge, because it's not fair, it's unbearable, and he can't, and he's crying helplessly, rocking back and forth, clutching Dean's body, like a child just saying, "No, no," and Dean stirs in his arms and says weakly, "Dude, are you getting snot on me?" "Oh, God," Sam says, a benediction, and fumbles at Dean's clothing desperately to get Dean's heartbeat under his hand, shoving aside Dean's hands when they batted him feebly. It's there, it's real, and Sam's got his cheek pressed against Dean's close enough to feel his breath, so he really is smearing snot and blood and tears all over him now, and ignoring Dean's half-hearted flailing. So happy, and he's crying even more. Dean finally quits even paying lip service to trying to push Sam off, and he slides his hands up under Sam's ragged clothes and wraps him tight. "I've got you," he says against Sam's skin, his lips moving and soft on the curve of Sam's jaw. "I've got you. I'm here. We did it. It's over. I've got you." And Sam gasps out, "I know. I know," unable to stop crying. Dean stops talking and holds him closer, one hand cupping Sam's head, just his face warm and wet against Sam's cheek, his breath coming hard. Then he turns Sam's head and presses his forehead against Sam's and says, "Sam, Sam," and Sam's still gulping sobs when Dean covers his mouth and kisses him, just once. It doesn't actually register. Sam's shaking so hard, and he's so cold, and it just feels like comfort, the most natural thing in the world, like Dean's hand on his face, Dean's breath mingling with his. They're still clinging to each other when Joe's cell phone rings out behind a pile of trash, and she says groggily, "Mom?" And Charlie stirs in the pentagram, lifting his head slowly, bloody but alive. They all stagger outside together, make it down the steps, and get out of the shadow of the church and into the sun. Sam slides to his knees then and topples over, taking Dean with him, still clinging and tangled together on the grass. Joe gets two steps further and bends double and starts vomiting, Charlie grabbing her by the waist to help steady her. Her arm is still horribly torn and bleeding from the revenant bites. Tires on gravel. Sam vaguely wonders if they're all about to get arrested. Whatever happened must have made at least some noise, he thinks. He doesn't care all that much. The police will have to take them to a hospital first, and make sure Dean is okay. Anyway, right now he could go for a few years in jail, as long as they don't try to take Dean away from him.
The footsteps stop.
Guess we missed a hell of a party, Bobby says.
6 other hunters are with him, hard-faced men and women whose hands are gentle laying Gordon and Lisa and Reba straight, and helping the rest of them into back seats.
My car, Dean says, half asleep, but awake enough for that, while he and Sam are all but lifted into the back of Bobby's Subaru station wagon, which has the rear seats folded down and filled with a layer of blankets and old defeated pillows.
Don't get your panties in a bunch, Bobby says. I'll pull her off into the bushes, bring you out here to pick her up once you're on your feet.
Don't scratch her paint, Dean says, eyes already closing again.
Yeah, yeah, Bobby says, rolling his eyes.
Hey, what kept you? Sam asks Bobby, just on the edge of fading himself, but fighting it off as long as Dean's awake.
What do you think? Bobby jerks his chin at Dean. Nobody else in this world I'd let talk me into playing second string, he says, and shuts the hatch back on them.
The sun comes in through the windows, and the pulse of the engine idling under them is familiar. Sam nudges Dean's cheek with his nose.
You were scared we were going to lose.
Was not, Dean mumbles. Knew we had it in the bag.
You had a backup team.
Dean cracks an eye and glares at him. It's called taking precautions. Now shut up and go to sleep.
I love you, Sam says.
Dude, seriously, Dean whines.
I love you, Sam says, grinning against Dean's cheek. I love you. I...
Dean turns his head and bites Sam's ear, hard. It's the softest bit in reach.
Ow, Sam says, and he'd smack Dean, but he's not willing to risk hurting him.
Shut up, Dean says, and throws a leg over Sam's hip and presses his face against Sam's head and sighs into sleep. Sam waits until he's breathing evenly, then he worms his hand back into Dean's clothes and spreads it over Dean's heartbeat again, slowly and carefully so he doesn't wake him. He doesn't really feel tired somehow, but his whole body relaxes as Bobby puts the car in gear and they're on the road and moving.
Dean needs 12 stitches, and at the hospital they put him through an overnight stay and 2 CAT scans before they grudgingly agree that he's avoided a skull fracture and he's allowed to leave.
Although I have to tell you, Mr. Reynaldo, the doctor says, looking over at his chart, I'm seeing signs of a couple earlier head traumas. You keep this up, you'll be at significant risk of suffering permanent brain damage. It's time to start avoiding extreme sports.
Yeah, I've been thinking about giving up the snowboarding, Dean says, his thumb running over Sam's knuckles. They're holding hands because Sam pretty much hasn't let go of Dean except for the tests and bathroom breaks. He knows he's going to have to detach at some point, but as long as Dean keeps leaving his hand conveniently in reach, Sam's going to postpone it. The nurses whisper about them, and some of them smile.
Come on, let's get out of here, Dean says. I want my car.
The front seat of the Subaru isn't meant for 3 big men. Bobby eyes their clasped hands and says,
You two still look like death wormed over. Go lie down and back.
Sam's ready to be careful, to lie down on one side and just hold Dean's hand and nap, but that goes out the window after Dean crawls in after him, shoves him flat and gets settled on top of him, leg between his and arm curled around behind Sam's head for a pillow. Sam opens his own jacket and pushes most of Dean's layers out of the way until they're pressed close enough to feel each other's breath through their t-shirts, and they both sleep all the way back to the car. Bobby parked her down a side road a good quarter of a mile away from the cemetery entrance, which turns out to be a damn good thing. There are a couple of police cars at the scene now. Aside from the usual handful of cops talking on their radios, there's a forensic team working on the gate and up by the church, and it looks like they're lifting fingerprints. Dean tucks his face against Sam's shoulder until they're by.
Mexico's looking better by the minute, he says, muffled.
You're gonna have to ride in the trunk just to get over the border, Sam says, taking the chance to stroke his fingers over Dean's head, through his hair. They climb out of the back seat and shake hands with Bobby, Sam's hand on Dean's shoulder, thumb sliding over the back of his neck.
You boys be good now, Bobby says.
eyeing them sidelong. You sure you don't want to come stay a while, just until you're rested up? Too many people know where to look for us at your place, Dean says. Come to think of it, he digs his cell phone out of his jacket and tosses it to Bobby, and reaches into Sam's back pocket and takes his out too. We're gonna hole up somewhere, lie low for a while. Bobby's eyebrows are rising. You planning on ever coming back? We'll see, Dean says, and unlocks the driver's side of the Impala and steps back to let Sam get in and slide over. They drive out through Lawrence and back onto the interstate, their hands still curled together, except when Dean needs his for the wheel or the shift. They stop before dark, after only a couple hundred miles. Dean closes the door of the motel room behind them, and Sam's heart is pounding crazily all of a sudden. Sam, Dean says. Sam, pushing him down to the bed, pressing his lips to Sam's eyelids, to his cheekbones, to his jaw, to his mouth, and Sam's shaking and clinging to him when Dean stops and presses his forehead against Sam's, panting. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Dean, Sam says, helpless, dazed. Dean says, I know you said, if you don't. And then he stops and says, oh, fuck it, just tell me if this is okay. And kisses him again, lick of quick heat into Sam's mouth. Yes, Sam says inaudibly, his mouth forming around the word, when Dean stops. Dean's eyes are dark, dark green. Are you sure? Sam, you've got to be sure, he says. Yes, Sam says. Dean shrugs out of his jacket and shirt, and then he's got Sam's off, too, pulling the shirt up and over his head while Sam raises his arms obediently, and then Dean's pushing him back down against the pillows, possessive and hungry, saying, asking, can I, let me, I want, and Sam says yes, and yes, and yes.